This episode of DLC is brought to you by Alienware. So I've got a question for all the gamers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance. So I'd visit Alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark. Kaboom, rocking your ears, and wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to DLC. Especially if you're one of our geeks in sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Fear not, you'll have your mask on and we'll be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes. Actually, we're going to be in your ear holes a long time today. This is going to be a long one of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be. And that is completely free, thanks to our sponsor this week, Squarespace. Squarespace! Squarespace brings the show to you. DLC, of course, the show all about games in their many forms, games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, that's spelled with two N's and one T, and I am joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis. The guy who's here on, I think, our longest episode of DLC of all time, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Everybody, this is the fifth time Jeff's done this intro. We've lost four episodes already. They've each been 4 hours long.
Not that longest. Not that longest. No, we got a full show for you. We got tons of news to talk about. We got tons of games to talk about. And at the end of this episode, we've got a full over 1 hour spoiler-filled discussion, deep dive into The Last of Us Part 2. No other podcast with Christian Spicer on it will have such in-depth discussion of The Last of Us Part 2. That is my guarantee to you people.
Not until July 7th. You're right. You are correct.
But we got David Chen from the Slash Filmcast and from Culturally Relevant podcast to join us. We got Dan Trachtenberg, big-time Hollywood director, to join us, personal friend of Neil Druckmann. And we had a really, really excellent full-on deep dive into the game. Dave did not like the game. And
he's overstating it, and people can listen. He liked it less than the rest of us.
He provided a strong counterpoint. Anyway, you'll hear all of it. If you would like to hear spoilers, if you've played The Last of Us Part 2, I urge you to listen to the last hour of this podcast, because I think it's a really great discussion. But if you haven't and you're wanting to avoid spoilers, we're going to make it easy for you. We'll flag it. It's at the end of the show, and you'll still have 90 plus minutes of awesome gaming content, because we have a fantastic guest to dig into the news, to talk about games we've been playing. You know, the DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian. But this week, I'm so excited because DLC stands for dialogue for legendary characters. Because we have the writer on Mortal Kombat 11 and Injustice 2, as well as the Image comic book Heart Attack. Sean Kittleson joins us for the first time. Hey, Sean.
Hey, that was epic. That was awesome. Thank you for that.
It is a fraction of what you deserve. We're fans of your work. We're excited to have you. Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to be a guest on the show, just make several AAA, be part of the team that makes several AAA video games that I love, and also a comic book that I can't stop talking about. And it's that easy.
That's all you got to do. Just clear those small hurdles.
And then text with me for about a year about random stuff. And then eventually we'll find the time.
Hey, you know, that's actually a great point. Before we get into the show, and yes, we are going to have a big, long, meaty show. So, we got to get into it. But we have you here, Sean, and I'm curious for folks listening, how does one become a writer for video games? How does that job happen to a person?
I think it happens differently for everyone who's in it. I haven't really met two people who got in the same way. Some people get in through QA and then work their way over to a design or a story department and then find their way into writing. Others come in from other mediums or media. Can't talk tonight. I studied playwriting in college at NYU, and I really thought that I was going to be writing film and television. And I did. I sold a screenplay right out of school, and I was getting writing work, and things were going really well. And then the economy crashed. and there was
Which
a
time? You gotta be more specific.
this was an earlier economy crashing in 2008. And so I needed a job. And I had worked for an author named Douglas Rushkoff as his editorial assistant. And I told him, Doug, I really need money. And he was like, I'd love to help you. And I was like, no, I'm not hitting you up. I need this job. And I can't get an interview with DC Comics. And he said, well, I'll call Paul. And that was Paul Levitz, who was the publisher and CEO of DC at the time. So I was actually, I believe I am the last person hired under the old DC regime before the move to the West Coast.
Wow.
And I was also one of the first people to move out to the West Coast. So that was my first job in games, was this I saw a gig for assistant editor interactive, and it looked like the job was all about come play our games and tell us if Batman and Superman are authentic. And I was like, I can do that. I've got a degree in dramatic writing and a Superman tattoo on my back. I was born for this. And that was my way in. I ended up working with studios like Rocksteady, NetherRealm, and forge relationships that ultimately, you know, brought me to writing Injustice 2 and Mortal Kombat 11 with Dominic Cianciolo over at NetherRealm, and to some of the work that I do now. So for sure, it's been a long road, but the road is different for everyone. I always say whatever your way in, you got to find it. Whether it's eating your humble pie and asking somebody like, I really need a recommendation. I really need help. I can't do this myself. Do it. Do what you got to do. Because there is always a way in.
I thought you wrote for TV for years, like decades, really. And then you realized after 50 years of writing for TV that you weren't satisfied. So you turned the hourglass over. You said fine.
If only I could reboot 2020. Yeah. I've been praying to Kronika.
Right. I think it's amazing that you're in a position now where you're like, I wrote on a fighting game, more than one. I wrote on fighting games, and everybody's like, wow. You know what I mean? Like, not too long ago, writing on a fighting game wasn't even really a job, you know, and how NetherRealm has created these fighting games that have awesome stories that are really well written. The cutscenes look like TV, feel like TV. Whatever movies, whatever you want to say, they look amazing. And I think that's a credit to you and the team. It's really elevated a genre that, you know, really wasn't known for story.
It's being on that team was such an incredible honor and something that I think was a really unique moment in fighting game history to me, because I grew up with Mortal Kombat. Like, I was a Mortal Kombat kid when I was too young to really see over the joysticks. And I was the kid that all the older kids were swatting away, like, get out of here, kid. Scram. Right. But I was so into it. And I remember my dad taking me to see the movie. And then to grow up and end up working with NetherRealm, making a game about the past and the future colliding, or the past and the present colliding, and working with Ed Boon and a lot of the original team members, as well as now multiple generations of fans who grew up loving these games and got the chance to make them professionally. And it has brought out the A-game in everyone that I know on that team.
Great. That's really cool. It shows. Those games are fantastic. All right. Well, let's jump in and talk about some gaming news and start the show the way we always do, with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happen in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. That's where you can send story suggestions, comments, questions, anything. We love hearing from you at dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also visit our subreddit where folks hang out, talk about the show, talk about video games and all sorts of things. A great community over at 5x5dlc.reddit.com. All right, Sean, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Oh, wow. I think my personal one was Cyberpunk 2077 getting so much coverage all of a sudden, whether the Night City Wire episode that aired after a delay, or the impressions pouring in. And I'm wondering, are you two gentlemen among the many people who have had access and hands-on with this game?
Sadly, no, we are not. I'm a little jealous of some of my my colleagues who had been handpicked to get early playtime. But I also kind of feel like I'm ready to just jump into that game. I don't need to play for 4 hours and then not get to continue that moment, that journey, that save game. But I am definitely jealous. But yeah, you're right. There's been a lot of new info. As you said, we're getting side content filling out the universe, the lore of the world. I'm sure as a writer, that seems particularly cool for you, right?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, there's a studio in CD Projekt Red that is known for one of the best narratives, if not the best narrative of the generation in Witcher 3. And they seem to be doing something that no one else can do, which is it's an incredible feat.
Well, it's neat that, you know, obviously Cyberpunk 2077 is built on an existing property. It's a tabletop role-playing game that's been around for decades. So it's not starting from zero, but it also, I think, is pretty cool that they recognized that this isn't just the next game for them. This really is a new pillar for their studio, a new franchise that has a huge world with all kinds of really interesting content that's been built it over decades. And it sounds like the game is very, very true to those tabletop roots that it is drawn from. But, you know, this anime series from Studio Trigger, Cyberpunk Edgerunners, sounds really cool. It really feels like this is going to be a major part of what CD Projekt Red does for a long, long time.
I can't imagine them taking this long to launch it and then watching it dry up. I think we're going to be seeing Cyberpunk for a while. Hopefully it has the kind of life that Grand Theft Auto has had this generation.
Yeah. Based on the stuff that you've seen so far, Sean, what is in this early coverage has you most excited?
I think Brain Dance, the how important multiple perspectives are going to play in to not only can you choose one of three characters or three scenarios to begin the game with, but that as you play the game, you're constantly taking on the role of others. There's something really powerful about that. Mm-hmm. And learning through other people's memories, I think, is something that way back in the day, working on Arkham Origins with WB Montreal, the attempts to input more investigation and detective work, I've seen how difficult that work can be and how tough it is to scale it. And what they've done is so ambitious and so such an excellent puzzle of sorts to include within a game that you would never expect to have that much control over scrubbing back and forth. It's almost like they put the Invisible Hours, the VR game where you can scrub through time back and forth, into an RPG that already had plenty of mechanics and systems to support it. Didn't need this extra thing, but here you go. It's a huge extra piece of the world now.
Christian, have you been checking out some of this early coverage? What is your high points from it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's super impressive. Like, for starters, apparently the demo, like, the visuals are incredible, right? Like, apparently the demo was running through GeForce Now and for a lot of folks, and like ray tracing on and maybe locked at 1080p because of that. But I mean, just the visuals I've seen in like the 4K trailer that CD Projekt Red uploaded is just that neon drenched city with ray tracing and the water and everything. It just looks like a world that I want to just like explore, you know, like the Assassin's Creed history mode kind of approach. I think I just want to kind of get lost in that world and walk around it a little bit. But I'm very curious to spend a bunch of time with this game, because the trailer they released for it that came out, you know, the same time as like the story trailer, there was a lot of talk when The Last of Us 2, I think it was like their first trailer, second trailer came out, like, oh my gosh, this game looks so violent, it's so brutal. And it goes for like a more realistic, like, brutality style approach, in my opinion. But this trailer for Cyberpunk, it was very violent. Like, very violent and action-packed and like, to me, I got the impression, like, isn't this cool? It was like, explosions! Blowing up people, murdering people, and being badass, like bombastic, like music hitting. And it was a super impressive trailer, but I got like that more action movie style vibe from it. And then as I read through people's experiences playing the games, it's like, oh, this is a deep RPG. You know, I could spend an hour in a menu, you know, if I wanted to, obsessing over what I'm doing and how I'm changing my character. So I'm really curious to see kind of how CD Projekt Red walks that line between a potentially bombastic, action-packed, steal a car, blow up a train, kill everyone in a room, jump out the window, you know, land in a dumpster and escape kind of huge action set piece style game, and Brain Dance, you know, where you can spend 4 hours just shifting, scrubbing, realizing, doing whatever it is. And I have at this point every expectation that they will somehow find that balance. And that's based solely on The Witcher 3. Whereas I watched, you know, Witcher 1 to Witcher 2 and then Witcher 3, I think they really did find that nice balance between third person action, hack and slash, which is maybe a little derivative, not the right word, but style gameplay, but also with very deep RPG mechanics. If you want to play the game that way, you can also play story mode and, you know, kind of ignore a lot of that stuff. So to me, that's the thing I'm most interested about for Cyberpunk, is kind of how it balances that deep RPG style gameplay with a run and gun shoot 'em up style. I don't know. It blows me away.
Yeah, I remember sitting there at E3, however many years ago that was now, three years ago, was it, that they first debuted the gameplay footage, and it was that crazy behind closed doors, and here we are, we're going to see Cyberpunk for the first time, and all of a sudden it's first-person shooter. Yeah, and that, to me, was my biggest worry is, oh, I don't want to play this game like Call of Duty. And I don't think we will. Clearly there are systems and systems and systems, and there's a lot of role-playing stuff. All of the shots are being calculated. Those dice rolls and RNG are all happening behind under the hood. But it also, I think they kind of are making it possible for people to play it in a very Call of Duty kind of way. I think there is a play style there that is viable. And it'll be interesting. I think you're right. I think it'll be interesting to see how that all balances out and how it feels and what your instincts will make you want to do as somebody that's played a lot of first person shooters. Will you feel like you're supposed to go in guns blazing? And maybe you are, maybe you can play the game that way, but I'm certainly more interested in a more considered role-playing game. I mean, that's not how I really played The Witcher, right? There's a lot of hacking and slashing in that game, but there's also like plans, research,
this make oil your traps. On your sword, and
exactly. Yeah. And I'm sure that'll all be there too, you know. But it's a different thing. I keep having to say this over and over that I was ready for Cyberpunk to be a skin for Witcher 3. You know, I thought it was going to be, hey, what if The Witcher, but future, you know, but Cyberpunk. I would have been perfectly fine with that. And the idea here that they're actually doing something wildly different from The Witcher and reinventing how their games are played is exciting, but also to me a little scary, just because I liked The Witcher a lot and I like third person action games a lot. You know?
Well, I think you've seen them on their learning curve from Witcher 1 to 3. And they've grown and adapted in a lot of ways in a Rocksteady like fashion, from something that was more limited in scope to something that was a bit more ambitious to something that was a lot more ambitious. And they keep every time they take a bigger bet. And it seems like this time, obviously it seems like a far bigger bet, but I have to imagine that everything they've learned collectively as a studio is really coming in handy and making this possible. It does seem like in the way that a lot of the bigger games now seem, including Last of Us 2, you're like, well, this is a rare event, because how often can a team come together with this level of experience, with this level of funding, that they can sustain production for as long as they need to, with as many bodies as they need to, in order to create this thing that shouldn't exist. It's impossible, and yet it does.
Yeah. Boy, the last few months of this console cycle are just like, wow, you know, megatons being dropped all over the place. But luckily, we don't have to wait too long for Cyberpunk 2077, because my sources tell me it's out in June. So here we are. Wait, what? What's that? Oh, I'm sorry. It's out in September. What's that? It's not out in September either. Oh, November 19th. Okay, November 19th. Until notified again. November 19th is when we all will be playing Cyberpunk 2077. But we all want them to make the best game they can and delay it as much as possible, as much as needed. All right. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week? There's lots of juicy stuff, man. There's a lot. What a week. We're like, what? It's faux E3, you know?
What a week. Sean, blink twice if I'll be playing the next Arkham or Batman game in the next 12 months. Great. Got that confirmed. Thank you so much for that. There is news there, but that's not really what I talk about. My story of the week is the other deep dive that we've seen in a game that's coming out soon, still soon. We got, what do they call it? War Stories or something? I don't remember what they called it. But the Avengers, we got a bunch of Marvel's Avengers information. We got
Christian, I don't mean to cut you off, but I have to say that I think this story is officially part of the Summer of Games.
It's the Summer of Games, or DLC. You're gonna get hyped up, and the news will live up to your expectations.
I think that might apply for this, too. I think it might. I hope
just
it doesn't.
Set everybody's expectations correctly.
Are you guys over the hype cycle? Am I detecting that?
No, I'm not. You'll notice it's not my voice at the end of that lovely clip from Sean Madigan.
I'm not over the hype cycle. I feel like oftentimes, you know, the hype doesn't live up to expectations. That's all. I mean, I don't know. I'll ask you at the end of the show, Sean, how this episode went to you. And
all right. So sorry, Christian. I just wanted to frame that correctly. All right. Marvel's Avengers, new info.
Big, a lot of new info. We got a new trailer, deep dive into what kind of the PvE style gameplay will be like, the hero missions, or like the single player where you kind of play as one hero. We saw Kamala, and we saw Thor levels, and we saw the customization, War Zones. That's what the co-op stuff is called. And you know what? I think I'm excited. I don't know if you all watch this, but I think it's weird. So here's the thing, right? Warzone stuff, it looks a lot like Destiny, right? In my opinion, in terms of like, it's going to have a campaign, that maybe will help get you progressed through and leveled up, but it's not going to be, I don't anticipate it being 30 hours or something like that. And then you're going to have these war zones where you're grinding and leveling up and gearing up. And as we talked about, Destiny 2 is one of my favorite games of, I forget what it was, like this past decade or whatnot. So now it looks like they're taking that and putting some of my favorite comic book characters of all time into a game. And they have the combat designer who designed God of War's hammer throw, I believe, is now part of this team as well, or axe throw. And it's like, this is all the things I like. They took chocolate and peanut butter and put them together. But I still think, I only think I'm excited. It's weird. I'm not sure why I'm not.
What's
like,
holding you back? Yeah. What's holding you back? Cause I saw this and I'm legit super excited. Like the co-op stuff, the gameplay looks really fun. I understand that that first trailer they showed was a little underwhelming in terms of looking like next gen or something, but this isn't next gen. It's a current gen game. And I don't know, man. I'm so into Marvel stuff.
I think this is it. And I hope I'm wrong. Like, I'm very excited for the game, but I think these are things that I'm just like not quite there yet with it. I find games where you spend most of your time just like blowing up kind of nondescript looking robots often to be kind of boring. I don't know why that is, but I'm just like, oh, here's this robot. Like, where? How are they?
I mean, that is Destiny. That's Destiny.
No, it's not Destiny. Destiny, you're killing aliens.
Oh. Very important distinction.
It is to me. It really is. It really is. Something about like just the horde of robots just really gets me excited. And then War Zones, I want to see how they do some sort of story or connective tissue through that. Like if it is just like very distinct things where you go in and grind through. I think that's what's missing for me is the wrapper that pulls it all together. But I will say after watching this presentation, War Table, what did they call it? I'm much more excited for the game than I was after E3.
I think it was War Table.
War Table, yeah. War Zones is the solo AI hero companions or co-op groups of up to four for Avengers. And I think this is the first time we've really even seen the co-op stuff. I mean, it was a montage, obviously. It wasn't like fully showing it, but they showed some of the menu system and everything. Sean, did you, I don't know. I don't know how much your allegiance is to DC or if you're sort of.
not at all. I mean, I love, okay. I'm a Superman person. That's my like way into all geek culture. That's my route. But mm-hmm. I have a son named Clark whose favorite superhero is Spider-Man. And he would far prefer, he would far prefer to have been named Peter. and fortunately, like I grew up at a time before Marvel versus DC really mattered to anybody. I was just happy that another kid knew what comic books were all about.
Right.
So
yeah. How does your son know that he was actually named after Clark Diggleborn, who was just a friend of your dad's?
he's named Clark because he's a little gentleman. That's what his mom.
Oh, that's great.
But no, I mean, I love Marvel. I think Spider-Man for me is up there in my top two, maybe favorite superhero games of all time, along with Arkham. Arkham as a franchise, I would put Arkham franchise and Spidey franchise are now neck and neck as my favorite superhero franchises in games. But
yeah,
I saw the E3 presentation last year. And I remember feeling kind of numb after it. This feels better and more polished. I am cautiously cynical about the quality of combat interactions, only because it's even for a studio as big as Crystal, it's a lot of different characters and modes to take on and to polish and have work effectively with each other. And the robot enemies that we've seen that Christian pointed out, they are kind of concerning because they make you wonder how interesting combat can be, how boss battles will play out in ways that won't be quick time events. What will the systems add up to? There's so much of this game to see though. I could also chalk all of my misgivings up to messaging problems because they have so much to communicate. And this game from day one has suffered from a real critical question, I think, in consumer eyes, which is, what is it? Is it a...
yeah, what is it? What is it? We know it has Avengers in it, but what is it?
Destiny yeah. suffered yeah. that same problem, and so did Destiny 2. You know, people are like, it's how everything. Different? What is it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, that's a tough strategy.
Yeah. I think that's an astute observation. My only retort is... MODOK? It's got MODOK. I'm MODOK. In because it has MODOK, and they showed MODOK, and MODOK's in it, and now I'm super excited because I saw MODOK.
I was not vibing on the story when it was more focused on A-Day and Cap's sacrifice and all that, especially, I think, coming right off Avengers Endgame. I was like, all right, I've seen enough of these guys die. Let's go easy on them. But I do think that, at least in this week's footage, Kamala Khan made such an impression on me that I was like, okay, they're doing right by her, and the way that she's presented in the story feels like a great role for that character. And I hope the story's great. I hope I can enjoy it with my son.
Yeah, I'm super excited. It's funny. There's so much stuff coming out in the next 4 months that, or I guess it's more than that, 6 months. But I kind of forgot this game was this year, and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm super excited about this. There's so many things that September, October, November is just going to be unrelenting, a drink from the fire hose of video games, and I'm here for it.
No disrespect to someone launching a game in August that I'm forgetting, but I feel like August is the only little breath we have. It's just. Oh.
I'm sure there's August stuff that we're not
I'm
thinking
sure
of right
now.
I'm sure
there is, too. But I mean, like, that's the only maybe breath I can think of. And then
because we got July stuff, big July stuff, and then I'm sure there's August stuff. And then September hits. I mean, this is September 4th, right as September begins. So
July is going to beat me up between Paper Mario, Ghost of Tsushima, Iron Man VR.
I know Iron Man VR is by the time you hear this show, it's out on Friday. I guess it's maybe by the time you hear the show,
by the time you hear this show, the one person listening on Friday.
I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. There's so much news to talk about. I think my story of the week is going to be something that isn't super new that we heard this week, but we haven't talked about it yet on the show. And I think it was the first time it's actually been really confirmed. And that is that there is going to be a hardware subscription for the Xbox Series X. Now, this is something that I've been talking about on podcasts for so long. I mean, since the earliest Weekend Confirmed days, we would talk about, you know, as soon as the iPhone came out, really, in like 2007, 2008, and there was these subsidized cell phones became the norm for like 10 years, everybody was like, well, why not do it in the console space? Why not have a subsidized console? If they're making money on the software anyway, why not help you get into the console by paying a subscription fee or having some sort of way that is all backloaded? So that you
like
get the console
interest-free loan. We've seen some stuff of that too. It's like it ends up being about the same price, but you're paying it over months instead of, you know, $600 up front or whatever.
Yeah, but I mean the idea, you know, you get your cell phone, you pay your cell phone bill, and that is for the service, and they give you a phone for free. So many of us had said for years and years and years, seems like something that could happen in the video game space. And it sounds like finally that is going to happen. Xbox Series X console, according to Phil Spencer, will have a hardware subscription service. Now, this is actually something they've been doing already. It's called Xbox All Access. They've been sort of test marketing it. It's been rolled into Xbox Live Gold and Xbox Game Pass. And it's been successful in small markets, but it sounds like we will be seeing this rolled out on a national, if not global scale, with the launch of the Xbox Series X. So the idea here is that you pay monthly and you get the box. You don't have to pay the $4.99 or $3.99 or whatever it's going to be up front, but you get yourself a shiny new console generation and it's rolled into your Xbox Live Gold. Maybe your subscription goes up, maybe a little, maybe a lot. We don't know the specifics, but I think the idea of this happening is pretty interesting. And Sean, I'm curious if you think it's a net positive for consumers.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think we are this year more than any other in a console transition that I can remember. We're in a position where I don't know how many people can really afford a $500 or a $700 purchase.
Yeah.
And especially the economics, particularly in the United States, shift toward debt spending, and people not having larger amounts of money to spend. That's why subscription models are taking root the way that they are. It really is about meeting consumers where their wallets are. You can attract a lot more people with that monthly fee than you can with that larger ticket price, even if it earns out over time. It doesn't really matter. It's more about what you have today, not how much you could have tomorrow for so many people. So I do see it as opening up and making this next generation of consoles accessible to people who I think would be priced out.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that Microsoft is doing so many things to make this next generation like cell phones. I mean, really, honestly, I think they've really learned from the Apple's model and Samsung's model that the line, calling it the Xbox Series X, feels like they are embracing this series of hardware SKUs. We've heard they're not going to have exclusives to Series X for the first year that it's out, that everything that they publish first party wise will be backwards compatible to Xbox One, so that if you buy an Xbox One, you can play Halo Infinite. It feels very much like embracing that idea of, you know, whichever iPhone you have, you can play pretty much everything. There's only going to be a few things that aren't going to work on the new iPhone for a few years, or for a year at least. And the pricing model, it sounds like they're borrowing that as well. And I think the net will be more accessible to more people, like more people can jump in. But Christian, you know, a lot of people criticize cell phone companies for this, for tying you into 2-year contracts and stuff like that, and feeling like that's not something that is beneficial to a lot of people. Are you concerned about that in any way?
Well, I think cell phone contracts and like Apple, you know, they kind of have their own trade up program. I think a lot of that stuff has become less predatory than it was before, where they would really lock you in and you couldn't switch and there were all these penalties. And if you really added up what you were paying and all these fees, and it just kind of became exorbitant. And now I think those costs are a little more clear. There are still certainly problems with it, in my opinion. But I think with what they've been doing with Xbox All Access, with Xbox One X and stuff before, I think they've shown an awareness to being upfront with what the costs are and breaking it out. And like, it's over this 2-year period. If you get rid of it before that, you know, you have to pay this amount. And it wasn't that much more. If any, maybe it's like $10, if I'm remembering correctly, then like just paying it all up front. And they're just trying to get you into the system. And I think it's a smart way to do it. And if people are hopefully, you know, still budgeting themselves appropriately, and that they know they want to have this console for 2 years and have these subscriptions, I think it's a great way to provide that kind of entertainment to people that otherwise, you know, might not have access to it, or would wait for that a year or 2 years for a hardware price drop. And I think the smart part about bundling it with their services, and if you have a box and Game Pass already, you're gonna be playing a lot of those games. And when Xbox's first party games are coming out to that service, it's hard when you're price shopping. You know you're looking at the competition. It's like, well, I can get this box for $400, whatever it is, $400, and then I gotta buy, okay, I want to buy that game and that game and that game. Okay, and I got to get the online subscription so I can play multiplayer with Call of Duty. Okay, so now I'm at $900, $1,000, or I can pay $45 right now and be good. Yeah. That's a lot.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is for both of you, is this the way you would buy an Xbox Series X? Sean, would you buy it up front, or would you buy it via a subscription like this?
I am considering the subscription. I bought a day one Xbox One and have regretted it ever since. If only, I love you know, Microsoft games, and Xbox has, I think, the best UI of the generation. However, it has a faulty disk drive. It has all of the problems that you get from Gen 1 hardware.
But you and get that cool little stamp that says day one right on the little controller.
I sold my day one controller.
It's a collector's edition.
I have felt somewhat the disk drive failed like within a year and I couldn't get it replaced. And I did kind of feel like a sucker ever since. So having the subscription option available to me is attractive. There's also the problem of Spider-Man Miles Morales coming out on the PlayStation 5, and my son pretty much from the moment he saw the trailer, just determining like, we need that PlayStation 5 day one. You know that, right? You know that we need that. You know that if Christmas comes and goes and the PlayStation 5 isn't here and Spider-Man isn't here, I can't live. So that's
I will renounce my Clarkhood.
Yeah. I will legally change my name to Peter, Dad. I'm escalating this.
Amazing. Yeah. Christian, what about you? You think you would do subscription style?
So short answer is no. And here's the specific reason for why. I already have like 100 years of Game Pass. So I don't need to.
We don't know the specifics of the pricing or how that would all work. You don't know if it's a separate subscription from Game Pass. You don't know if they would bundle it. We don't know exactly how.
I have so much Game Pass and Xbox Live already that, I mean, if it's just the price of the console without those subscriptions, maybe. But at the risk of being called out as a hypocrite later, which I very much welcome if I change my mind, I don't plan on buying an Xbox like ever.
Whoa, what?
I have a really great computer. And all of their games are, I'm super curious how they sell me there. And maybe they don't care. You know, I have a good computer with a nice SSD, good GPU, good CPU, and they say their games are coming on it. So I'm very curious if there are any advantages to playing it on their box versus just buying their games via Game Pass or the app that I have on my computer. But right now, if I had to guess, I'm going to have a PS5 and use my PC for everything else.
Do you really think that Halo Infinite is going to be day and date on PC?
I think they've said as much.
Have they? Oh, maybe I'm just not.
I mean, all their games, Xbox Studio games, have been since they announced that, and they've announced it's coming to Windows 10. I have to imagine it is. If they haven't,
yeah, I believe it is. I believe they're all now Xbox Play Anywhere.
All right.
They call it. Yeah. So that's what I'm looking at right now. Again, as someone who was looking at like stupid cameras the other day, like tech lust is, I have a problem. So I don't, you know, and my PC, you know, computers can create their own problems. So I might be like, I just want to play the game, you know, so I reserve the right to change my mind. But yeah, I do not plan on buying a new Xbox.
I don't think Microsoft cares where you play.
I agree.
Well, I think that's the messaging. Yeah. And I'm a little surprised by it, but I think it's a positive thing. I think to say, hey, we're just trying to get these games to you, play them on the box you already own, play them on the PC you already own. As long as you're giving us your subscription fee to Game Pass and or purchasing the game, we're happy. I kind of think that's progressive and interesting for the whole industry.
Think of it as retention is a lot cheaper than user acquisition. So
that's true too.
What they're looking at, you know, overall market scale is that the console market will always be somewhat larger in so many ways and more mainstream than the PC market.
Yeah.
And if they can add, in addition to the console revenue, which largely will not come from people who also own a high-end PC.
Yeah.
If they can also add your monthly subscription money to their offering on the console side, that just helps mitigate risks on their console venture. So,
right. And certainly a game as large and expensive as Halo Infinite, it's nice to be able to sell it to the install base that you already have both on PC and Xbox One and not say, hey, this by its very nature, smaller install base, even if you sell a million consoles in Q4 2020, you're still a fraction of what you've already sold for those other install bases. So
yeah,
it makes financial sense.
I think Absolutely. The only thing you're potentially missing out on is that like writing to the metal, you know, like what would The Last of Us 2 be like if it had to be on PC and support from a 960 up to a potentially, you know, 3080, whatever the next, you know, like how that kind of scales, or tapping into the SSD instant load times. Like, could I play Ratchet and Clank on my computer? I don't know.
They're already, I think, thinking that way, though, because if you look at Last of Us 2, for example, you know there's going to be a really cool looking PS5 version of that that's going to have all kinds of effects that you can't get on the PlayStation 4. So in so many ways, developers are already having to think that way.
Yeah. Yeah, we've already Cyberpunk is going to have a big patch at some point.
Exactly. For the specific edition, you know?
Cross-gen, cross-buy makes that, it really changes the economics for developers. Because whereas before, if you were going to support the higher end hardware, you knew that you were going to have dedicated revenue coming in for that title, for those features. Now, you have to design for a whole spectrum that runs from the Xbox One up to the Series X, or from the PlayStation 4 to the PlayStation 5, if you want to capture the maximum audience size. And in Microsoft's case, you know, if you want to play in Microsoft's pool right now, that's the way that they're playing. They're very pro consumer and let you play anywhere on anything. So scaling like that. And it's, I think, not just in the console market, you see it in the mobile market, because mobile CPU and graphics power has really pulled away in the last few years. And we still have to support iPhone 6.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah. I think what they're giving up by doing this way is they're basically conceding initial sales to PlayStation 5. If you're going to compare one-to-one console sales, I can't imagine they'll sell as many units of the console if they're not asking people to buy it in order to play Halo, right? If you can play Halo and not have to buy this is the Clark effect, right? Clark says, hey, I want to play Miles Morales. The only way I can do it is to get a PlayStation 5. So dad, it better be under the tree come Christmas. That same calculus isn't required for the big Microsoft releases, right? If you don't have to get the console, I'm certain fewer of them will be sold. I think that's an interesting thing. But then again, you know, we balance it out with this story, which is, well, maybe the counterbalance is, you know, hey, mom and dad, I want a $500/$600 console in the PlayStation 5 for Christmas, or you can pay $45 a month, which is, again, a number we're making up out of nothing, but and give me the new console under the tree. That may be a balance for those kind of initial numbers. We'll have to see.
I really hope your son's in college one day instead of taking like Econ 301, 101, and they talk about the Clark effect. It's like becomes an action.
All right. I want to take a second and thank our sponsor, which is Squarespace. Oh, man. Websites. We all need them. We all use them. We all love them. Maybe you want to turn your cool idea into a website. Maybe you want to blog or publish content. Maybe you want to publish your work. Maybe you've got an actual business and you need to have it be online. Maybe you just want to announce anything, really. We're all staying at home. The only way we contact each other is with the internet. So why not build your website yourself? Instead of having to pay someone to make your website, instead of having to learn HTML, you can use the tools at Squarespace. The simple, what you see is what you get, drag and drop tools of Squarespace to build your own website. Make it yourself, make it stand out, make it look cool, because you start with their professionally designed templates, but it's so simple to just move stuff around and change it and make it how you want. Invariably, you end up with something unique that expresses what you want to express. With just a few clicks, it's so simple. Plus, they have powerful e-commerce functionality that you can just drop right in. You don't have to worry about how it's going to work. It all is seamless. Everything works for mobile right out of the box. You can buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions so you can get exactly the website you want to get people looking at your stuff. They've got built-in search engine optimization so people can see your stuff that way as well. There's never anything to patch or upgrade ever. They handle all of that in the background so you don't have to stress. But if you do have any stress, 24/7 award-winning customer support will help you work through it, and they'll get whatever you need fixed in no time. Squarespace is the place that I built my website, jeffcanada.com. It's a place I constantly recommend to friends and family who say, hey, you're the guy on the internet. How do you make a website? I go, ugh, it's simple. Squarespace.com/Jeff sent me. That's where I send people. Check it out yourself. You'll get a free trial. And then when you're ready to launch your site, use the promo code Jeff sent me, J-E-F-F-S-E-N-T-M-E, all one word. Save yourself 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain. That's squarespace.com/Jeff sent me. And the promo code Jeff sent me to get yourself 10% off. Thank you to Squarespace for supporting this show. All right. I would be remiss. I know we're already going to be, this is going to be a long episode. It's amazing. It's a marathon, not a sprint. But I would be remiss having Sean here and not bring up this new tidbit of information about Rocksteady's next game, which evidently is going to be called Suicide Squad Kill the Justice League. Now, I don't know what information we can squeeze out of you. What I don't know what you know. I don't know what your opinions are, if you can even say your opinions. But I have to bring this up because you're here. And also because I know, Christian, you've been anxiously awaiting Rocksteady's next game. And it sounds like the domain SuicideSquadKillTheJusticeLeague.com has been purchased. It evidently is the working title of the next Rocksteady game, which, you know, speaking of stuff that's happening in August, WB is having their... What's that?
DC Fandom.
DC Fandom. Yeah, we're having a big WB event that was going to be their E3 presentation in August. So invariably, or not invariably, so I suspect we'll be seeing this game announced there alongside whatever the next Gotham game is from Montreal Studio. But Sean, is there anything, any insight or any opinions that you want to, that you can share about this?
Sure. I mean, I was a creative exec for DC most recently 8 years ago. So that was the last time that I had like the full slate at my fingertips. And certainly that predates anything that would be coming out now. When I left, we were pretty deep into story development for Arkham Knight, and I had played the first couple of milestone builds for that. But that game itself was still 3 years out, at least. So that's how far back my time at DC goes. And then other than that, I worked on Injustice 2, but I was on the complete other side of the table than I was used to being on, where on Injustice 1, I was the person at DC giving the notes and telling NetherRealm what was authentic. And Injustice 2, I was the one getting notes, which was a really fun way to turn the tables on myself.
Like from yourself, you'd have one computer, or you'd be like, here it is. You'd get rid of the computer and be like, this is horrible. Here's what you need to change.
Yeah, it was like a sequence straight out of Looper.
like, this guy doesn't get it. And then your response is, no, that guy certainly does not get it.
but certainly, I think, you know, a Suicide Squad game of any kind, and I, like I said, I have no, the projects that Rocksteady has been working on, I didn't know about Arkham VR before that came out. So that was a nice surprise. And when I caught up with the team at E3, the year that they debuted that, that was such a monumental moment for me. It was my introduction to VR, but that team is so, so talented. And Suicide Squad, if you actually go back and look news archives, the game, Suicide Squad game was announced in 2010 at San Diego Comic-Con. I was there. And at the time, I had actually written one of the first pitches for that game, as we were trying to get developers interested. So it was on me to break down a deck of what is the Suicide Squad, who are the characters, what would be some interesting ways that they could be utilized in games. And then we'd go out and talk to developers and see if we could get them hyped. And there was a project at one point that was not anything coming up now, but that was a canceled Suicide Squad project. I probably worked on more canceled DC games than I worked on like games that actually got released. And I got to work on a bunch of classics, but you know, Superman games, Justice League games, Suicide Squad games, like the list.
Please tell me there was a Booster Gold game in there somewhere.
Oh, we tried. We tried so hard.
That's what I want.
So Booster Gold, like, and Blue Beetle was a real priority for us. So when Injustice 2 came around and I got to write Beetle, that was a real pleasure.
That's cool.
But in any case, I think, you know, whatever Rocksteady has been doing, if they've taken this long, I have faith in them that it's going to be, if it is something as big as what Suicide Squad Kills the Justice League sounds like it would be, I can't wait. My only hope is that it's not too grimdark.
Yeah.
Like there's a real risk there of like, oh man, I don't want to go back into that too grimdark territory with these characters. I've been there plenty. So we'll see.
That's my concern too, honestly, especially with that title where it's like, but I like the Justice League. I mean, I think the idea of having a fight where you're going up against Batman, you're going up against Superman. I mean, honestly, did that in Injustice games, right? That's a very fun notion and a fun wish fulfillment to be like, okay, can I take down Superman? That's a cool thing. But again, the world is so dark right now to have literally the symbols for justice and truth in the American way be the enemy. I mean, I guess it tracks right now, but man, it's rough. It's rough.
It is.
Yeah. As someone again, who has like potential reservations with Avengers, even though I do like Destiny, but what I really want is just more single player Destiny. I think if I look at my heart of hearts, to me, I'm very curious if this is a single player Rocksteady game or not. And
yeah, maybe 5-on-5, the Suicide Squad versus the Justice League. Maybe I can play as Superman.
I feel like with Suicide Squad, there's more room for that loot customization gear kind of thing without people getting so upset. I mean, we're talking Injustice, and I think I really loved the progression and kind of the grind in that game, and we saw it in later Mortal Kombat games. But there was blowback from, you know, air quote fans when that was announced. It's like, that's not a real suit. Like, among others. Yeah.
And that used to be my job. I used to be, that's not the suit. But that was also, I think the way that I ended up working with Ed Boon and company was in so many ways, it was my job to kind of be that person, but not be that person and try to be an advocate. And that's how I ended up working on Story with them. You do that by
coughing. It wasn't the suit. You know, you be that person, but you're not that person.
I had Ed and I had a really amazing negotiation one day where he came to the office for a meeting and a tour, and before anything else, he had brought pictures of Batman and Superman, and he kind of like put them down on my desk in my office at DC and said, "Let's figure these out here and now." and we settled up on Injustice 1, Batman and Superman.
And you pulled That's out funny. Your own pictures and you were like, here, take these and scene.
We were detailed. But it was always, you know, about preserving the spirit of the character and making sure they were recognizable while also, you know, providing enough ground for NetherRealm to do their thing, for Rocksteady to do their thing. Yeah. That's what I think produces the best games, is not hovering as a licensor over the people you're working with. I mean, I'm the narrative director at Skybound now, and I oversee all the Walking Dead games, and it's the same. I practice the same principle whenever we meet with a developer or someone's pitching a game or we're pitching someone. The first thing that I say is, listen, we're not trying to get you to recreate some canon version of the Walking Dead story that you know from the comics. We want you to do something that you can put your own stamp on. And that's the way to develop games. I think that's why CD Projekt Red has done so well with Witcher. They took their own initiative to expand the lore where they felt it was appropriate. And whatever Rocksteady does, it's going to be the most version of that thing, right? Like it's not going to be a halfway, half measure. It's going to be the most version of that game. So I expect it to be pretty seismic whenever they announce whatever they plan to announce.
Christian.
Saints and Sinners on Quest release date already. Sorry. I get some water. Excuse me.
Christian, I know you are, despite your need for water, very excited. Very excited for Rocksteady's next, as we've all been waiting for, it seems like forever now. Does this fall in the category of, oh man, what a pleasant surprise? Or is this fall in the category of, I wish they were doing something else?
If it ends up being games as service style game, I'm going to be like, this isn't what I wanted, but I hope it's great. If it is, you know, single player narrative based, whatever, and I'm playing as Harley, yes, please. Yes, please. I love the Suicide Squad. Most versions of them I find compelling. I love the idea of being playing a huge roster of disposable characters. There's so much fun that's been had with the Suicide Squad, and they tried to do it in that first movie too, but it just, to me, that moment fell flat. But I love the idea of like, who is the, oh, that's, they're nobody. Okay. Great. You know? Yeah. So I think there's a lot of fun to be had in that world and with those characters. And I think too, you know, the emancipation of one Harley Quinn and what Birds of Prey or whatever it was called. I really, really like that movie. If you haven't watched it, recommend it. I think it's
underappreciated.
I agree. Yeah. But I think that movie also could have easily have been called like Harley Quinn Kills the Joker, you know, or something like bombastic like that. And so I think kills Justice League. You know, I think there's a lot of room for that to play out a lot of different ways, but I'm optimistic we get to see both of these in August, and I'm kind of through the moon that we might get WB's and Rocksteady's game within 12 months from now. I'm not expecting either to be launch games for next gen, but
no.
I'm excited to see them and hopefully get some.
I don't know anything, but Montreal, it's been so long since they released a game, so I can't imagine that they're too far out.
I could certainly imagine whatever that Gotham game is, the Gotham Knights, whatever it's going to be called, being this year. But all the words we've heard of these leaks for the Rocksteady game is that it's squarely a next-gen title and will be released into the next-gen lifespan. So it'll be probably, I'm guessing, like a 2021 at the earliest kind of game.
With my luck, it'll launch the same day as Horizon 2. You know, like you're just like, come on, you waited so long for this.
Yeah.
Game.
Yeah. Right. All right. Speaking of waiting long, lots of games that we have been playing. I know there's still tons of news to get to, but let's talk about the games we have been playing in a segment I call the playlist. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist. All right. Time to talk about the games that we have been playing. And let's start, before we even get to the games we have been playing, I'm fascinated by something that Sean shared with us before we started the recording. And that is, Sean, a lot of us have been playing Last of Us Part 2 lately, a very big game, lots of discussion. We will have a full spoiler discussion at the end of this very episode, in fact, for that game. But you have done something that I think, I'm guessing, not an insignificant number of people have done, which is you watched that game rather than play it. Last of Us 2 just came out and you spent time just watching the story like it was a movie, right? Is that how you did it?
Yeah. I don't even know if I would have done it that way had I not normalized the behavior for myself by like checking out my own cinematics on YouTube and like watching reactions. Anybody who says they don't is lying. You always want to know what people think, but yeah, no, I played the first game and, the ending did not land with me in a good way. It landed in a bad way. And so I was kind of reluctant with this.
You still
game.
Had your tray table down, kind of thing. And
yeah, oh,
terrible joke. That is a terrible joke. I'm curious. I want to dig into that because it landed in a bad way, meaning you didn't buy it from a character perspective, or it just was so dark and so disturbing that it kind of soured you?
And this is part one we're talking about.
Part one. If this is still unspoiled for you, you're too late. The ending of part one felt like it cheated me. And I have, by the way, I'm coming at this from the sense of like, I've been making games for a living for a decade now. And I tend to think about how I want to do things when I play a game. And in so many ways, in my mind, the version of Joel that I built up was going to say goodbye to Ellie. And when I started murdering people en masse and then took off with her and robbed her of the chance to make a difference for humanity, I felt robbed of the chance to make any choices in that situation, because it felt like the sense of dissonance that I had, and not even ludonarrative dissonance, just dissonance of like personally what I wanted to do versus the character. And I know that part of it is about forcing you into that path in order to make you reflect on it. But personally, that's not the style of like game design and narrative design that I'm a fan of. I don't like being railroaded into a scenario that ultimately leaves me feeling soured or cheated by the choices made in the game. So all that said, obviously we're talking about games that are technical masterpieces. We're talking about games that are expertly written, acted, directed, animated. The teams that pour their years and of their lives into creating these are working at the peak of their craft. But I did feel that there was a big missed opportunity in part one. And the more coverage that I saw about part two, the more skeptical that I became. I was like, I don't know that this is really going to change my mind about how I feel here. So I said, all right, instead of, I play a lot of games. I play games for myself. I play games with my son. I play games for work. So I have to be kind of selective with my time, and committing 20 plus hours to The Last of Us 2 wasn't something that I was prepared to do. And after the month that we've had in June so far, I don't think I was emotionally in a place where I wanted to in any way. Even the good reviews, I listened to you guys talk about it. I watch reviews, I read reviews, and even the good reviews were like confirming for me, like, "Hey, buddy, this is gonna rub you the wrong way." Like, I just I would hear things and they would almost trigger. And it's certainly
fair. Yeah, sure, it's totally fair.
It's not to be clear, it's not an SJW thing or something where I'm worried about Neil Druckmann putting too many diverse characters in. I'm certainly the king of SJWs in so many ways, according to the internet. What to me is the issue really is the lack of agency that you have in these narratives. And I think that there is great value in the cinematic narrative tradition. However, it's really important, I think, to distinguish the difference between interactive narrative and cinematic narrative. I think that the areas where The Last of Us most excels are cinematic narrative and the execution of it. I do believe that the gameplay is valid, the level design is incredible, all of that, but it is ultimately a really, really beautiful cinematic narrative that is still in service of the same kill gameplay. And I say that as someone who's written a really violent game and someone who plays violent games. It's really, if you ask me to take your story seriously, I will. But if I take your story seriously, and then I still have this sense of cognitive dissonance when the way that the characters interact, the choices that they make, do not follow what I think human behavior follows, right? It's this is where I say dissonance. It's a sense of sometimes you're in the room and you're like, I don't understand what everyone else is seeing. And I think that the conversation, the discussion, all the praise that you all have had for the game certainly comes honestly. But I also think that there's it really depends where you're sitting when you play that game, or when you enjoy the story the way I did, via clips. Even though when I say clips, we're talking like 12 hours of clips. So
yeah.
I don't know that it counts as a season of television.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. It does. I mean, it's longer than most Netflix shows at this point. I'm curious about how that, I mean, clearly you saw it through, right? You watched the 12 hours, yes, whatever it was. So you stayed to see it through. Did you feel any satisfaction in that? Did you appreciate that experience for what it was? Did it sort of alleviate some of the feelings because you weren't making the choices?
I think no. it confirmed for me that I was glad. I felt I would have been really frustrated had I played it. And yeah. I think, you know, I imagine I probably would have had the similar empty feeling that a lot of people have described, in the sense that you have a lot of fun while you're playing this game, and then you finish it and you have a lot to think about. And sometimes even while you're playing it, you have to stop it and think about what you're playing and why you're doing what you're doing. And all of that is great up to a point. But I don't know how to put it, except to say that games have a capacity. Games are like Kal-El in the movie Superman. We can be a great people, and we wish to be, but we lack the games to show us the way. And wow. There are very few studios in the world that have the cinematic prowess and the technical prowess and the budget and artistic license to create games that are not murder simulators.
Yeah.
And in so many ways, to me, the gameplay of The Last of Us 2 is an uglier, more realistic, more brutal murder simulator. And the momentum of violence in that world is so unnaturally heightened that the situations that the characters put themselves in or find themselves in is crosses lines that I can't follow. It's why there's certain movies that, for me, like No Country for Old Men, doesn't work for me. Doesn't add up to anything for me. I need some sense of catharsis and not just catharsis of an idea has been completed. I think of games as therapy. I think of games as opportunity, and stories the same way, to engage with the things that we need help deconstructing, the information that we need help sorting through in our lives. And this game, to me, doesn't have any nutritional value in that category, because of the statement that it's trying to make, and in the way that it's trying to make it. I'm trying to say this without spoiling anything, but in so many ways, where The Last of Us Part 2 ends is where I would have liked a game to begin. And I would have liked to see what that character, who's now made a different choice than maybe we would have expected to make in the moment that she makes it, how she goes forward from there. Without spoiling anything, I think I'll leave that there. And readers can connect the dots, or listeners can connect the dots in your extended segment after this.
I think you have spoken very eloquently, actually, about that position, and it's quite persuasive, actually, to me, that what you said. I certainly did get something out of the game, and people will hear us talk about it later. But I remember that moment when I heard Neil Druckmann say, you know, our first game was about love, and this one is about hate, and I was like, do we need that? Do we need a game about hate? While I was moved by the game and felt I appreciated sort of what I was put through and how I came out the other side, I sympathize with what you're saying. I think that's a very astute point, and certainly not a game for everybody. That's what I said from the beginning when I finished the game, is this does not feel like a mass market product. this is not the feel good hit of the summer. You know what I'm saying? This is not game.
That's the thing that I think represents the greatest missed opportunity. And look, I hope that Naughty Dog takes this as a challenge and picks it up going forward, is that if you're going to take swings like this, where you're willing to burn your existing fan base in order to make something that has artistic merit and has questionable market potential insofar as the limits that the content itself will place on reach and access. If you're willing to take that swing, why not take it on something that's really unproven? Because although the story takes a swing, the gameplay is about as safe as it comes. And there is a sense of efficiency and like I said, the momentum of violence that is there is typical. It is what we make as games. And the reason why so many games are made that way is because they don't have the budgets that Naughty Dog has. They don't have the studio financial security that Naughty Dog has. They don't have the largesse and the ability to sway the industry. And I fear that this game, instead of inspiring a new generation of cinematic games that are able to imagine interactivity between human beings that takes forms other than punch, stab, and gun, that instead that, you know, the knockoffs that we will get for Last of Us 2, as people hold it up and say, oh, this masterpiece, I want to make something like it, that, you know, there's a lot of things that tried to follow in the Christopher Nolan footsteps of the dark. And they're like, oh, they just went darker and it didn't work. And I do see the potential for, oh, people are going to take the worst possible interpretation of this, like watching Scarface and forgetting how it ends.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can't lay that at the foot of the artist, but yes, I
don't
take your point.
And I guess I don't lay it all at the foot of the artist. I you know, it's on all of us. And I also think, you know, I wouldn't lay it on the foot of any one person because one person can't make a game. And Neil would certainly say that himself. I'm sure that, you know, it's a team effort and a studio effort. And I don't know if you're going to marshal those resources and you want to do something revolutionary, it teach me to do something I don't know how to do already.
Man, I think it's profound. And I'm so glad we had you on this episode to say those words, because I think that's a fascinating perspective and one I haven't heard articulated quite like that. So thank you. Kudos. Appreciate it.
I say that as someone who's done a lot of soul searching myself about what I'm creating, what I'm putting out there and what it means.
Yeah, no, I clearly that came through, and I think it is it's certainly something that I'm going to be chewing on for the next, you know, little while. I think that's a really, really interesting perspective. It's hard to transition between sort of the deep thoughts of that discussion and talking about the other games you've been playing. But I'm curious that you have a number of really interesting games that I haven't tried yet, including Desperados 3, which just came out. And I know is getting a lot of attention. What's your experience with that game?
It is so rootin' tootin' good. Desperados 3 has, I am the kind of person, I guess I would put it, that real-time strategy has always seemed more appealing to me than it was in practice. Like, I would see the Commandos games and I would say, this looks like a game I'd love. And then I'd play it for a few hours and kind of bounce because it was difficult or it was obtuse in some way. And Desperados 3 is the game that I think perfects what the UI of one of these games and the experience of one of these games needs to be. Insofar as if you've ever played a tactical game and felt like, well, I just don't know what the right thing to do is, or I don't know where the right place to, I don't know which line of sight I can use. I don't know which angle is the best angle to approach from. This game gives you so much information without overloading your senses and tells a great story and has really interesting and memorable characters. It is so lovingly crafted and wonderful to play that it's addicting. It's less of a strategy game or a tactical. It's a puzzle game. I think of it as you enter these scenarios. I guess I should break it down for people who don't know. It's a game set in the Old West. It takes an isometric view. You can rotate the map all the way around so that you can take a look at any angle. From above, from your bird's eye view. And you control a group of characters, or in some cases, just a single character, as you attempt to move through a map, achieving objectives, clearing out enemies, which you can do at times non-lethally, sometimes lethally. Sometimes you don't have to, you can just stealth past them if you so like. And there are so many different paths and options for you to take, and approaches and strategies and different ways that you can combine the skills and abilities of your various characters that are so creative and so holistically designed, I would say, and that everything connects to itself. So you could come up with these really cool scenarios where I'm playing on PC. I don't know how this controls on a console controller, but on PC, you know, you hit the shift key and time freezes and you get to choose and queue up actions for your entire team. And then you can either execute those actions right there at that moment, or you can tap shift to go back into the scene and wait till the perfect moment to strike. If that moment's taking too long, you can fast forward to that moment. If you try to execute that move and it goes wrong, that's okay. As long as you press F5 to quick save, you can press F6 to quick load. Like, the game is so intuitive and user-friendly that even when you encounter these really difficult combat scenarios or stealth scenarios, you can't help but just keep going back to it. It's really got me enthralled.
Man, you're making me want to play it. This is Desperados 3 that we're talking about. I think it's on Steam Summer Sale right now. I'm tempted to grab it myself.
Although it's so worth it. It's $50 and worth every penny.
Desperados 3. You've also been playing a game I know that's got a pretty big following. Deep Rock Galactic. This is the sequel to the first Deep Rock game, right?
Yes. Have you played it yet?
I played the first Deep. What was the first Deep Rock game? Deep Rock something else. I have not played the new one. No, I haven't.
This is, I mean, it's space dwarf mining, co-op perfection. I would say a mostly non-toxic community. There was one run where we were so close. You have to, every run, you start by, you know, dropping down into a cave, and you're going to explore that cave and mine and blast your way through walls and battle enemies and probably resuscitate each other frequently because you're often overwhelmed by hordes of enemies. You have four character classes that all have different abilities that complement each other, but you can also stack them up. So if you want to have a bunch of gunners, you can just try that. It's a really flexible game. But you know, it relies on you having real human beings that you want to play with. And voice chat is not a necessity. I've played plenty of games with strangers, but there is no substitute for having, you know, four good friends in a group and partying up.
Yeah, I guess this wasn't a sequel to anything. I must be confused. But
I was wondering if I'd missed the first game. I was like, I didn't know there was more.
I am clearly mistaken. This looks like a ton of fun. So this is sort of, you're like hanging out with buddies and jump in and do quick action. But there's layers of like building and doing all kinds of crazy stuff, right?
There is, there's, it's more like destruction and mining. Like you can, all of the environments you can drill your way through, or axe your way through. There are, all kinds of huge verticality, to the level. So you have devices that allow you to create zip lines for some characters. Other characters can create platforms. The scout character has a grappling hook. And everybody has to work together to achieve the objectives. It's got a great just spirit to it. Like there's a big pair of fuzzy dice that are in your like space pod that you drill down into the terrain with, and then you have to come in and out of this thing. So you start in this pod, and then you have to get back to it. Like the end, you've mined your way hundreds of meters deep. And then they say, okay, the escape pod's going to leave, go. And then you have to run and dash your way in this frantic dash back to the pod. And everything about it just has this charm and this kind of Nordic, jovial, like having beers in Norway. That's what it feels like. Beers in Norway.
I think the whole team is Norwegian. I'm looking at website for Deep Rock Galactic, and it's Henrik and Jonas and Mikkel and Soren. Like that tracks to your experience with the game. Very cool. Deep Rock Galactic, Danger Darkness Dwarves is the subtitle. What else is on your playlist?
So I've had kind of an eclectic playlist lately. My son and I like to game together. He's six. He's put, you know, like 80 plus hours into Spider-Man on PS4, which is why he's so primed for Miles Morales. But we lately got into Rocket League, which I haven't played in years. But have you gone back to that game recently at all?
I haven't. Christian, have you played Rocket League recently? I know you were much more into it than I was at any point.
I have. It's probably been 6-7 months since I played any real. I had, you know, I'd played on my Switch when I was going places, but that's maybe that's only been 3 months. But it feels like longer.
It's a joy. It's a game that holds up. I don't think I've played it since like it launched. So to come back to it and to be able to play it with my kid, and he can. This is the first time I've seen him really navigating well in 3D. And the first time he scored a goal, it felt like real soccer. Like we were shouting and high-fiving, and that it's an absolute joy. And I'm surprised because we've played a lot of other games, but this is the one where he really seems to be mastering the dual stick movement. So proud of my little guy.
How old is he?
He's six.
Oh, six nice. Wow. Very cool.
He took to gaming very naturally. He always wanted to grab and hold a controller if I had one in my hand. And we've played a lot of Lego Marvel games together. That was kind of his real first entry into games.
That's cool.
But Ring Fit Adventure, I guess, is the other one that he and I play together. It's a great way to motivate him to work out. Obviously, the ring is a bit too big and unwieldy for him, but he just mimes whatever I'm doing. And that gives him a workout. He's sweating and huffing at the end of it. And so am I. Awesome. So Ring Fit Adventure kicking both our butts.
Hey, Christian, have you tried having your daughters play Ring Fit with you at any point?
No, they're interested in it, but I, you know, work out usually in the evening. So they have not seen it yet or done side by sides with me. Mm.
Cool. Were you one of the early Ring Fit adopters, Sean, or have you picked that up recently?
I was lucky enough that I got it early. My wife bought it for me as a gift because she knew how much I was looking forward to it. So
that's awesome.
I've had it for a while. I gotta say, throughout the pandemic and the lockdown, like it sucks to be locked down and all of that. But like there have been days where I would look around and be like, I got two Oculuses, a Nintendo Switch with Ring Fit Adventure. I'm so good. Like I'm good. I can adapt.
No, I've said that from the beginning. I was like, I've been training my whole life for this. This is the moment that I have been in training for since I was six. Yeah.
Indoors the kids unite.
Exactly. Indoors kids. Finally, everybody has to feel what our life has been like. anything else you want to bring up?
I guess I went back to Witcher 3. Because of GOG had a not a sale, but a giveaway where if you linked your PlayStation or Microsoft account or Steam, they would give you a copy of Witcher 3 on GOG. So I linked up my Sony account, got my Witcher 3, modded it up with some high res textures and beautification mods. None of the more raunchy and sexualized mods. Those were rather disturbing to find. I was like, what the heck? How many 12-year-old boys have modeling skills like this? That's crazy.
Yeah, no kidding, right?
But it is, you know, going back to it, we've talked a lot about Cyberpunk today, but Witcher 3, so it still holds up. I've beaten it. I've come back to it. I intended to play Hearts of Stone. Once I got to Velen, that's when the quest line opens up for you because I haven't played any of the DLC for it. And by the time I got there, I was like, I just want to keep going. Like this game, I don't need the DLC. I could just do this campaign forever.
It's awesome. Yeah. And I'm hoping we haven't heard. I don't think we've heard a word yet whether Cyberpunk will support mods. But the games that support mods feel like they build communities that are longer lasting. You know, the fact that Bethesda games support mods and the CD Projekt Red games support mods, it feels like that just by its very nature gives it a longer tail than most games get because people are invested and they're improving the game and adding new stuff. You know, GTA 5 having mods, for example. I know it's not easy for
Battlefront 2, the original Battlefront 2 had an incredibly, like it's still active. There's still a community for that game because of the mods.
Cyberpunk literally needs to have mods of all games. That's the game that needs to have it.
I've been playing a lot of stuff. I could go on, but I don't want to suck up all the air.
Not at all. It's great to hear about all these games that we haven't talked about in a long time or at all. Like I said, this show could be, this could be a 4-hour one this week. Christian, what's on your playlist?
Well, I didn't write this down. Just two little things. My 7-year-old daughter started playing Pokemon Sword on her own for the first time. She's, you know, both my daughters are very into Pokemon, and they loved watching me play Let's Go Eevee and me playing Sword. And she's like, she wanted to try it herself. I think she maybe has a little bit of my temperament of like getting bored quickly. I'm like, it's a lot of reading. Just know this is not the show. This is not what you've watched me play. Like, your first, you know, half hour of screen time here you play is going to be just picking your character. You know, like you're not going to be, but she has been loving it. Like, I've tried to film some of her reactions, but like the first, you know, battle she won, the first trainer, because I forget like who, like Trainer Bill or whatever. And she's like, "Dad, it's a trainer, another trainer. Oh man, I'm going up against a trainer." And it was just like, just pure joy to watch. And she dismantled this first trainer, because that's where you are in the game at that point. And she's like, "I knew I was going to beat him. I have water gun." So it's really fun to watch and see her enjoying that. There have been some questions about like the progression and things. She's like, I thought I'm allowed to have 6 Pokemon in my party. I'm like, "You are. Why do I only have 2? Well, the game, it's onboarding you. What's onboarding, Dada?" It's like, "Well, come here, my dear. Have a seat. Let's talk." But it's been really fun to watch. The thing I've been playing, I think I maybe mentioned this before, but as I invested more in like an actual home office, I have an Uplift is the brand, but a standing desk. And now after the move, I finally have my Mega SG hooked up again and some of my retro stuff. And I've never done it before, and it's the silliest thing, but I was playing Genesis games with my desk raised to stand, and I was like, this feels like an arcade. Just that shift of perspective. And then I have an old Genesis 6-button fight stick. I got that out, and I was playing some Punisher. Surprise! I'm talking about the Punisher on Genesis again. It's so silly how those little things I think we often take for granted of like what that arcade experience was. It's like I put the fight stick on the desk and I stood. It was awesome. Absolutely awesome. Like just the littlest, simplest, stupidest little thing. But if you have a standing desk or a place to kind of set something up like that, especially if you're, you know, been at home and you're bored or looking for projects, it was really silly how much life that brought back to games that I've played a million times. And I'm kind of hooked on it. I really, really enjoyed it.
That's interesting. That's very interesting. Very cool. For my playlist, I've been playing a game called Deck of Ashes, which just came out recently on Steam. I think it's been in early access for a while, but I hadn't played it until now. And I know, Sean, one of the games we did not get to on your playlist was Slay the Spire.
Yes.
And if you are as in love with Slay the Spire as I am, then may I introduce you?
No other games, because you're still playing Slay the Spire.
It just came out on mobile, Christian. Came out on iPhone.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So, you don't need any other games. You're good.
Well, allow me to introduce you to Deck of Ashes, because very much the same itch scratched here. This is a card-based battling game. The difference being that Slay the Spire is basically kind of this, you know, very much a roguelike, moving up you to different runs, moving up this this pathway, this branching pathway. You can make decisions and try to make the smartest decision as to what you need at any given time. And you know, you forks in the road that allow you to go to different places, whether it is to challenge yourself with another battle or to try to level up or find some items or whatever, and try to improve your deck and survive and manage your health all the way up to getting to the boss and moving on to the next section. So it is very much this sort of barreling down the road in one direction, even though you're able to pick your path. With Deck of Ashes, it is much more an open world feel to it.
in that you are still sort of moving from node to node on a map, but you can go backwards, you can go around. It is a field of nodes that change over time. Sometimes there's a bad guy that's always searching for you on every map, and that bad guy can change things, can blow up certain connections, can try to ambush you and force you into fights, can also drop temporary places onto the map that if you get to in a certain number of moves, you can get a cool recipe for a new card or something. But the idea is that you can move around to these nodes and kind of you've got this ticking clock to when the bad guy is going to eventually force you into a big boss fight. But you're using as many moves as you can in that sort of push your luck against the ticking clock format to power up, to get resources. There's all kinds of resources on the map that you then go back to camp, and there's various people at your camp that can improve things for you, give you traits, build more cards, buff cards you already have into being able to do new things, all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, there's a number, I think there's like five or six different resource types. There's keys that you can get to open chests that will have new things in them. You can research new cards types. You can buff those cards and craft those cards and build your deck. There's lots of options, and it's really, I think, a very compelling gameplay loop of sort of prepping for the battle and then having the battle. Whereas Slay the Spire feels like, can I survive and get powerful enough to get to the battle? This feels like, okay, I'm strategizing. I'm planning for the battle. The battle is the thing. The big battle with the bad guy is the thing. I've got a lot of these smaller battles leading up to it, but it isn't like this run the gauntlet and see how, if you can survive your way to the big battle. It's more like, how am I going to maximize the time that I have available to me to prep? And I think that one little tweak actually makes it feel, I don't know, I feel like I'm doing something rather than having things done to me. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It sounds like a combination, and just looking at it, very Slay the Spire in the combat interface, but there's so much else going on around the screen that isn't happening in the Slay the Spire interface. But it looks like it has elements, and it sounds like it has elements of Thronebreaker.
Yes. If you've played that, it does have that sort of progressing through a story. And also, I should note, there are, the game as it stands now has four different classes. And each of those classes has its own story. So you're actually playing a completely different story. In fact, some of them you'll start in on a completely different map if you choose that class. I played three of the classes so far. I played through chapter one on three of the classes. The first one I played was a rogue that uses lots of poisoning and damage over time effects. There was this like crazy jester character that is like this hybrid monster where literally bug arms sprout from its back and do crazy stuff. And all of his cards were very, very weird. You like summon a phantom version of yourself and buff that. I mean, very outside the box, really unique, very different play style to the rogue. And then there's a fire mage, and she, you know, does basically straightforward like blast, you know, combo fire stuff. And then there was a this like bruiser character where you generate rage, like a warrior type character with regenerate rage. But he also has like this furry, fluffy companion that you can buff as well. The point of me saying all this is that wildly different class types that play very, very different within the same card structure. And I found it, I really like this game a lot. It's called Deck of Ashes. I've been playing it compulsively. It's got that gameplay loop that I love, building up my deck, refining my deck, you know, turn-based card strategies. It's really cool because you see all the moves that your opponent is about the card your opponent is going to play. You see it all the time. You'll know exactly what the bad guys are going to do on their turn. So you can plan and plot and figure out the most efficient way to combo cards.
It's so my jam. And I think you'd like it too, Sean. It's called Deck of Ashes.
This is very cool. I'm definitely checking this one out.
Yeah. It's good. I think it's pretty inexpensive as well.
$20.
Yeah. Super worth it. I mean, this game is deep and awesome. There's tons to do. And I think they have post-release plans to add additional character classes and all kinds of stuff. There's also plugins. Talking about mods, this game supports plugins and they have like skins for characters. So like the crazy jester character is like a clown skin. There's all kinds of fun stuff.
Did I miss an opportunity by not playing Slay the Spire on PC? I'm playing it on the Switch, but I've heard the mod scene for Slay the Spire is pretty excellent.
Oh, well, that I haven't even really dug into the mod scene there, but I've read about it as well. And yeah, I mean, evidently there's all kinds of crazy stuff. And that, dude, what an amazing game that is. Just the story of that game, you know, talk about labor of love that turned into this big, big thing. And yeah.
That's a game I'd buy twice.
I bought it four times. I'm not even joking. I bought it on four different platforms. Yeah, it's pretty wonderful. All right. I know we're already long and we have another hour of show that will be tacked onto this. So do you guys want to do VR talk or should we bring you back some other time and talk VR, Sean? What's your feelings?
Oh, we could get on a ramble. I'll just tell people to play their Beat Saber and eat their Wheaties and that's healthy living.
There you go. That's great. I love it.
I mean, I could talk about, I will say this too. I guess I'll give one more VR shout out. Blade and Sorcery update 8. Jeff, have you played this game?
I have not played Blade and Sorcery. I downloaded it and I haven't even played it.
Okay. You waited for the right time. And I know, are you playing with like a beefy RTX friendly video card? All right, you'll be fine. This most recent update introduced some performance issues, but the trade-off is worth it because they've given you superpowers. So Blade and Sorcery, for anyone who doesn't know, is one of the best melee combat VR games out there. It has some really incredible physics systems and simulations of various materials so that the weapons that you're wielding feel like they have real weight. Characters and bodies, including your own body, have real weight. And now you can charge your staff with gravity energy and drive it into the ground and shout, "You shall not pass." And you will fling enemies into the air. It is amazing.
Dude, it's just like Gravity Gun meets Gandalf.
Yeah. I mean, you can grab enemies. You can like assign energy clasps to people, telekinetic clasps. So you can grab someone by the throat and like force choke them up into the air and then maybe slam them into their friend or grab them by the leg and just rip them in half because you're sadistic like that. talk about your violent games. But this is definitely not a story game. This is a game of visceral brutality and experience. And the implementation of superpowers, your ability or magic powers, rather, your ability to imbue any one of your weapons with fire properties, electrical properties, some of them using, for example, if you have like a really heavy mallet, right, and you have to swing this thing with two hands and you have to effectively mime that you are swinging a large heavy mallet in order to do it effectively. If you cast the gravity spell on your heavy mallet, you can swing that thing around like it's lighter than air, but it's still going to hit with the same force. Wow. Things like that. It's excellent. So Blade and Sorcery.
I always see it on top of the Steam most played list in VR, and I just haven't had a chance. I just haven't done it, but I'm doing it. That sounds amazing.
It's Blade a good like off day workout. Like if you're like, oh, I'm going to take a rest day, just like go into an arena, be a gladiator with magic.
Amazing. All right. Wow. Sean Kittleson, thank you so much. We definitely have to have you back. We got to talk VR. We got to talk tabletop stuff. This has just been a jam-packed, incredible episode, and you've brought so much to it. I'm so grateful you've been here. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Oh, thank you. This was honestly, I enjoyed the show. I could sing along with any of the bumpers at perfect pitch. So this is a pleasure for me. I really enjoyed being here.
Well, it was our pleasure. And tell folks, by the way, we do have our parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. But
tell folks where they can find out more about you and your goings on online.
You can find me on Twitter somewhat infrequently. I'm at Kittleson, K-I-T-T-E-L-S as in Superman, E-N. if you are interested in checking out my work, obviously check out MK11, MK11 Aftermath. If you finished MK11 and want to see even more crazy story from that, and definitely check out my comic book co-created with the amazing and brilliant artist Eric Zavadsky. It's called Heart Attack. It's a tale of superpowers, romance, and resistance in near future Austin. It's a book that's near and dear to my heart and something that I've been working on since 2014. So to have it out now in a year, it's a book that deals very candidly with police brutality, systemic racism and inequality and injustice. And that it has come out in this year and coincided with so many real world protests has been really, in a lot of ways, complicated for me to process. Insofar as this feels like I wrote a nightmare a few years back about what America could become in a near future. And then I saw America become that future in the time that it took for the book to get printed and produced. But I am donating all of my royalties for print sales of the book to the Southern Poverty Law Center in order to, I have been very fortunate to have the career that I have in games. I'm not rich. I don't get royalties on Mortal Kombat 11. I wish I did, but I've been very fortunate to have the career that I have. And that's why I don't want to profit off of this issue at this time in this moment in history. I want to be part of the solution. And that means that, not only should I be patronizing Black and minority businesses and boosting and amplifying Black voices, but I should really put my money where my mouth is. And that's why. So if you buy Heart Attack, if you buy it single issues, or you buy the trade, which volume one is coming out, it's called Against the Wall. It's coming out July 29th. You can pre-order that now. You can know that in some portion of that is going to the Southern Poverty Law Center through me.
It's called Heart Attack. It's from Image Comics. Pick it up. Christian Spicer, what about you? What do you got going on this week?
Staying on late to see what happens in issue 7. The book's so good. I've talked about it enough, honey. It's so good. I host the official The Last of Us podcast. New episodes drop on Tuesdays. I believe this week's is our final part one. Last of Us Part 1 episode, and then Part 2 episodes start on July 7th. There's stuff between there, too. I don't know if I'm allowed to say what they are. I don't think it's been announced. But the show's ongoing, right? The official Last of Us podcast. People seem to love it, and I'm so happy that people are responding to it. I'm really proud of the show and everybody at Spoke Media and Sony and PlayStation, and it's, an amazing team that came together to make something really incredible. So you can find that Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find me on Twitter at Spicer, S-P-I-C-E-R, and lurking in our Discord, in the DLC Discord. It's been fun to see that grow and see the fun conversations that are going on in there. And I'm in there as well. So come hang out and say hi.
Yeah, absolutely. As for me, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's, one T. And I have several other shows for you to check out if you're so inclined. I do a television and movie review show called the Slash Filmcast. You can find that at slashfilmcast.com. I think this week we're talking about the new Hulu movie, Shirley. Check that out at slashfilmcast.com. I also do a comedy science show that'll teach you some interesting information while making you laugh. It's called We Have Concerns. You can find it at wehaveconcerns.com. And then The Dungeon Run, which is my long form Dungeons and Dragons show, a show I am extremely proud of. Last week's episode was so cool. We had one of the coolest fights we've ever had inside this lighthouse. I don't want to spoil anything, But you don't need to watch a single previous episode to jump right into the dungeon run. You can start. It was episode 52, I believe. You can jump right in there. We recap everything you need to know right at the top. You can find it as an audio podcast wherever you get podcasts by searching for The Dungeon Run. You can listen to it or watch it on YouTube by searching for The Dungeon Run on YouTube. We've been on IGN right now. So if you're on IGN, you can find it there on IGN's YouTube page as well. Or live when we record Wednesday nights at 6 p.m. Pacific time at caffeine.tv/The Dungeon Run. All right, let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts.
Hey, give us a suggestion.
Sean, do you have a recommendation to help people get through their week?
Yeah. This I don't know if this is cheating because I know it's supposed to be a non-gaming recommendation, but so many people who I talk to, you know, do ask about getting into writing for games or express an interest in like what goes into writing games. If you wonder about that kind of stuff, if you've ever wanted to write an interactive game yourself, you can do it. And I would recommend Twine and Ink. Twine is a graphic user interface. Ink is more of a markdown language where you code. I find Ink is a bit more powerful while Twine is a bit more user friendly. So I think Twine is a good starting point if you've never designed an interactive narrative before. But these are skills that are free. If you have access to a computer or even an iPad, you can jump on the Twine website and you can start building stories that you can share with friends and family. Instead of giving my wife a birthday card, I wrote her an interactive short story.
Wow.
This year. And I actually
Superman was in it.
it was kind of sad and emotional, but also like uplifting, but it was actually a version of what her birthday would have been like if we hadn't had to deal with the pandemic so much.
But it worked.
And I was proud to present it to her because it represented something that no one else could have given her. And yeah. I think that's the thing. So many people out there have unique voices, you have unique ideas, but so many people don't realize that they have access to the tools that they need. And if you're interested in breaking into the business, if you don't have access to a fancy education, if you don't have access to a network of people who are already inside and can kind of give you the leg up, one way to start giving yourself the leg up is to start producing your own interactive fiction and your own interactive samples. And you don't need money and you don't need school to do that. I taught myself Twine with YouTube videos and wikis. So if I can do it, I'm not that bright. If I can do it, you can too. So that's my best advice. And then special mention for Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga, for keeping songs in my head all day long. And
I watched that last night.
Did you cry? Because I cried. I cried.
Really?
In spite of myself, I think I'm a real softy sometimes.
Oh, I am too, but I thought it was funny. There was a few jokes that I thought were just hilarious. Like when he's talking about braiding her hair and she's like, how long did that take you? six hours. I just thought it was so, very funny. But
excellent movie.
Yeah. Hilarious. Will Ferrell, peak Will Ferrell, where he's literally like playing a 20-year-old at 50, whatever he is.
Man, I remember years back, I was working on an unproduced spec about a 40-year-old boy bander who came back. It was called Jamie Day's Man Band. And it was all about this guy who like tries to reclaim his old glory, but he ends up realizing that he has to sacrifice his dreams so that his son can live a dream now. It's not his turn anymore. Very, very apropos, actually, for this
the film. Boy has become a man.
But the idea, I mean, even at the time, I was like, well, is Will Ferrell just too old for this? Like, because he really seems like the lead. And then this comes along, and I'm like, I should have finished writing that. Apparently it's still viable. But yeah. What a fun movie, and charming, and wears its heart on its sleeve, and is, like, surprisingly earnest for a Will Ferrell comedy. So,
yeah.
Good for the time. Something we all need.
Yeah, feel good, kind of goofy romp is fine with great music. Great, I mean the medley in the middle of that movie is unreal. Unreal.
Yeah.
So that's Eurovision. And then this amazing advice about twine and ink, which is just so great. I've never even heard of these things and they're available. So great.
They're what you use. This isn't like just awesome beginner tools too. Like I've worked in ink professionally on games, and I know lots of developers who have integrated ink or twine into their pipelines. So if you can teach yourself these tools, you're already giving yourself a job skill.
That's amazing. Good stuff. Christian Spicer, follow that.
I can and I will. One sillier, one more serious. Sillier, man, pad see you. And just Thai food in general. You know, like find your local spot that's being safe. Get some takeout. I had to run an errand today that put me near a favorite of ours, Jeff. And I swung by for some.
Yeah, they're still doing okay. They're weathering the pandemic all right.
When I walked in, I was the only person there. And then like as I was getting my takeout, like a line of like 10 people was behind me. I was good for them. But you know, support your local business, and also Thai food is delicious. Pets you with fried tofu. That's my jam.
Go to.
It's not healthy. Don't pretend like it's healthy, but that is my jam. The more serious one, and we didn't talk about it as like story of the week ever or anything like that. But I have seen and heard and read the voices of people calling out the expletive that hasn't been called out for too long in both gaming and in comics and in stand-up comedy as well. And I like to think that I'm an ally and I've been supportive and I help make workplaces a place that is a wonderful place for anyone to work at and for women to work at, and I'm a good colleague and peer. We all need to be better, you know, whether or not you think that you're perfect or not, or if you're not perfect and you've made mistakes in the past, as I imagine most of us have, take the time, do some reflection. And I know we say it at the end of every episode, you know, think about putting the world, but like for real, you know, and reading all of these accounts by all these women and just the bravery for them to speak up and to read about these horrible workplaces and things that they've had to endure in the mediums that I love and work in is tragic and heartbreaking. So yeah, Jeff, I will follow up twine.
I gotta say, I mean, it's kind of been a gut-wrenching, it's been a gut-wrenching year, but they're keeping new twists to the wrench. And I can say, you know, share a story, a personal one. I worked at DC the same time as Eddie Berganza. I knew him. I was friends with him. I had no idea what was going on, but I heard rumors. And the rumors you would hear, you would kind of explain away in so many ways, because you're like, that just sounds too crazy. Like someone wouldn't do that. And then, you know, to find out years later that not only were these rumors true, but the far worse things had happened. And to people who I knew and cared about and considered friends and who hadn't come to me because they didn't know that they could trust me. And that, you know, that, When I saw the name, I remember reading the report, and I know Janelle Esselin, and when the news came out from DC, as it has in so many places, I do remember thinking really, really vividly, like I was there. I was in some cases I was yards away and I had no idea. And that moment for me was an eye opener, because I always knew that women faced more hurdles and difficulties in the workplace than I did. And I've always made a point to make the women on my teams feel as equals as they should. And certainly it helps that I haven't been single since I was 21. Being a boring, domesticated man has certainly helped me out insofar as, I don't know how there are so many men who have so much time to harass so many women, because I'm just trying to do my job and keep my day going. And it's sickening to think that there are people out there that dedicate enough of their time and energy to terrorizing, harassing, and abusing people. And the only way that it will stop is if any time that you hear that rumor, that you take it seriously, that you don't dismiss things as just someone being funny when they're drunk, that you don't dismiss these behaviors as just hanging out, being crazy, that you let the people that are around you in your network and in your circle know that you are an ally, and make sure that they know unequivocally that you are an ally and that that is not acceptable to you, because otherwise you may be just yards away from something that someone doesn't realize they can trust you to help change and help stop.
I mean, it's, and you know, across industries for me, I think, unfortunately, and certainly in stand-up, that's where I know I need to do better. And I try, and, you know, hashtag girl dad and whatever else, you know, label some, and some of our reviews on iTunes have labeled me. but yeah, you know, being there and not checking in or doing enough. And like you said, maybe hearing rumors or whispers and kind of ignoring it. And that is a privilege I no longer want. And I need to do better. And now I will shift back to Thai food, Jeff, and say that my wife really likes pad Thai. And I also like yellow curry. Jeff, what about you?
No, you well said, both of you. Well said. Well said. I obviously agree with all of that. And
I said I wanted to sound like we didn't talk about it. I mean, it feels weird as a story of the week, but it's super important. And I don't want to pretend like we're not aware of it. And I'm very proud of this show, and I think and what it is. So, yeah.
Well, and I don't think it will just be the story of this week. I think, you know, this is an ongoing thing. And there's the Dr. Disrespect news. And who knows what spin that is going to take. Right now it feels like much gossip. But, this is a movement. In these industries, and it is about time. And it seems like in a lot of ways, what Me Too seeded has now fomented into Speak Out and campaigns like that. And it is about time. We should all know that these things happen so that we can prevent them.
Yeah. And as you said, it is an ongoing, it should be the new status quo, not just the story of this or any week. It should be just how we conduct ourselves from now on. And should have been forever.
I thought it was. I didn't know the social contract was so easily broken. I lived neither, in a man. World where that was not acceptable. But
We got a listener suggested parting gift. This was sent to dlcfeedback@gmail.com, which is where you can send any of your own parting gifts. If you want to give us a suggestion, or if you have any comments or questions you'd like to suggest or ask, dlcfeedback@gmail.com is where you send those. This one comes to us from David. David says, hey guys, thanks for all you do and for helping a dad with small kids keep up with the hobby I love. I wanted to write in with a parting gift for junior geeks and sneaks. It's called Cosmic Kids Yoga. It's on YouTube. The instructor tells a story and incorporates yoga movements in the story, in the storytelling. Those stories all have a theme, some of which are general, like science themes, and some are movie and video game themes. My 4 and 6-year-olds love the Trolls and Frozen videos. It's been a great activity for them since we can't go out of the house, and there are tons of videos to choose from. Anyway, keep up the good work and stay safe out there. Thank you, David. I have to admit, my daughter has been loving Cosmic Kids Yoga. She is 2. She can't even say the word yoga yet, but she says goga goga, and that means she wants to watch Cosmic Kids Yoga. This is clearly a YouTube channel that doesn't need our help. I think the Frozen yoga video has 14 million views, but it is worth noting if you have a kid and you want to get them up and moving. I agree with David. This is great. There's a Pokemon one that my daughter watched tonight, in fact. That there's all kinds of general, as David said, there's all kinds of general ones.
And it's this lovely woman with a very charming accent, using her imagination and using yoga, very simple yoga poses for kids. My daughter loves it. She raises her leg in the air when they do standing on one leg. She bends over and lays on the ground and does child's pose and all the fun stuff. So it's great. I can confirm Cosmic Kids Yoga is good for kids.
Let's give them that DLC bump. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like,
let's
show that's them what they need.
Let's show them what it looks like.
14.
I'm gonna subscribe.
Yeah, it's great. It's really great. She's charming, and it's a lovely little thing for kids. Like I said, my 2-year-old loves it. She watches it almost every day. We do a little yoga with her. I will add my own parting gift, which is another thing I watched last night. Wife and I hunkered down and ate some junk food and watched Netflix for a while last night, including Eurovision, but also a documentary called Magnetic on Netflix, which is like, it's almost could be a series of short TV episodes that are bundled together, because it's a bunch of short stories about extreme athletes who are doing crazy things like surfing the largest waves in the world and snow skiing down the sheer face of an impossible mountain, and kite surfing and mountain biking down insane peaks. And it's good watching. And I think that the thing that makes it so great is it's in 4K, and it's shot, like, so much of it is shot with drones. And you just realize, oh man, drones and extreme sports are just a match made in heaven. It really is how we should have been shooting this the whole time. The angles that you get, the perspective you get on what these athletes are able to do, and the, like, death defying stuff that they're doing. It's very compelling and very fun. And, you know, it's like a kind of a veg out, eat some food and marvel at the great photography. It's called Magnetic, and it's on Netflix. All right. That is going to do it for this portion of this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Sean Kittleson and Christian Spicer for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Sean Madigan, Zero Star, and Patrick L, for making those bumpers that we appreciate so much. Thanks to all the folks in our chat room for hanging out with us in real time. Thanks to all of you for listening. We appreciate you. You're about to hear our spoiler cast. Literally, there's another hour plus of show for you. So we are officially in the longest episode of DLC ever. Congratulations, fellas. We did it.
All right.
This is going to be a 3-hour and 15-minute episode. I hope you all enjoy it. I think it's a good conversation. I've certainly enjoyed this much. Until we talk next week, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place. All right, so it should be clear to everyone that we will be going full spoilers from here on out. If there is any part of The Last of Us Part 2 that you do not want to be spoiled about, or that you have not yet experienced, highly recommend you push stop now and come back after you have completed the game, because we will be liberal with our spoilers. You have been warned. So, David Chen, Christian Spicer, Dan Trachtenberg, so excited to talk about this game with all of you. I don't know where to start. Let's start with you, David, because I think of the four of us, you have the most critical opinions of the game. So why don't you lay out sort of your overall opinion, and then we can dig into specifics from there.
I purposefully did not watch your video because I figured I'd be experiencing it here tonight.
Yeah, well, first of all,
do your whole video again, please.
Also, yeah. But also because I never watch your videos.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. First of all, yeah, definitely check out the video that Dan refers to, which is on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/DaveChensky, where I reviewed Last of Us Part 2 in full detail. But let's I think I can divide my challenges with the game into a couple of broad categories. And maybe we could talk about each of these categories in turn, but let's just start with, like, how about the story of the game, right? Because I assume, like you guys, that story was the primary motivation to play the game. You know, I thought Last of Us Part 1 was a masterpiece. I know there's not people who don't think as highly of it as I do, but I thought it was brilliant. And it completely blew me away when that game was... the first time I played it was actually the PS4 remaster, and I thought it stood up really, really well. The questions that that game asked about, you know, what would you do in that situation? And it's like pretty complicated. It's like, I don't know if I was in Joel's situation, what would I do? Would I have done the same thing? I don't think he did the right thing.
For the record, we're not going to spoil the first game at all. Dave's going to talk around it, but we will spoil the second game instantly and say that Joel dies, but we will not.
would you have done what Joel did at the end of that one, which is not only get Ellie out of that situation and murder a bunch of people along the way, but not tell her, like lie to her, right? And like, I've been waiting now years for the answer to what happens in their relationship. And I do think on that level, the second game did deliver, right? I do appreciate that. We do find out what happens in The Last of Us Part II. What the fallout is of that decision, right?
It really is a game about the fact that they aren't given the opportunity to reconcile that rift. That we find out that Ellie discovers the lie. It shakes her and angers her. And then through the course of this game, by the end, we realize they were just about to get to some sort of reconciliation or coming to terms with their interpersonal relationship as a result of that fallout. But that was stolen away from them by this new character, Abby.
Right, right. And I have some further thoughts on the ending that we can get to later. But I think, like, fundamentally, I thought the scenes in which she's dealing with the fallout from the first game are awesome, right? Like the flashbacks, and you see her finally discover the truth when she goes back to the hospital. And it's like you said, she's shaken by it. And she's the character is literally shaken, right? She's like breaking down in violent sobs in that scene. And it's extremely powerful and moving. And so I really liked how that played out because it felt like it honored the character. But the problem for me with The Last of Us Part II is that, and there's many problems with it, but one of them is that it's a revenge story, right? It's primarily a story about revenge. The first game was about how are we going to save humanity? And the people in this chat may have a different opinion of whether it was actually possible to save humanity, like, you know, what decision was Joel actually making in Last of Us Part 1. But it was like, wow, this is a big, weighty thing. He has to get across the country with Ellie because he needs to save humanity. Like, it is an imperative. You would not forgive him if he didn't do it, right? Because he has to get this girl to safety. And in this one, it's she needs to kill this person, right? Because she's driven by this blinding rage as a result of what Abby has taken away from her. And I just think that's a way less interesting premise. It doesn't feel as weighty to me. The questions it asks aren't as interesting to me because we've already seen tons of stories like that of, hey, did you know that maybe if you end up taking an eye for an eye, it makes the whole world go blind? Like it might make you a worse person if you perpetrate further violence to try to correct the previous violence. You know, like,
I think you can be reductive about it in any number of ways, but I don't even agree with your framework that it's just a revenge story, because in reality, it's two revenge stories in that are happening in parallel in the timeline that you play back to back. And because it's two revenge stories, I found it to be a powerful, yes, a rebuke of revenge and hatred, you know, as you've kind of said in a kind of reductive, like, pat way. Perhaps you could take it that way. But I think the sum of its parts, because it's those two stories, and you see they are mirrored in so many ways, it really reveals the desperation, the cycle of hate, the motivations to be suspect from the start. So it is, I found it to be a powerful statement not in the way you're talking about, not in the, oh yes, revenge bad, revenge make you bad, violence bad. I feel like that's so reductive. I was in the shoes of someone who watched a heinous act to someone they love, felt motivated by it, and then asked to consider that in a completely new way through the eyes of a completely new character, and see how that is mirrored, and see how everyone is the hero of their own story, and how perspective is everything. And I found it to be much more than kind of how you're framing it.
All right. That is fair enough. I have a lot more to say, but I want to make sure to make time for, I want to hear what Dan Trachtenberg has to say. Like, what was your experience of the story?
Oh, I very much agreed with Jeff, especially like the notion that you're in those people's shoes, feeling a way about the mission that you're on, and then you are firmly out of their shoes and in someone else's and feeling a different way. And that was, it wasn't that binary. It actually kept flip-flopping throughout the entire experience. So I felt certain about how I felt about Ellie and what she was doing. And then I felt very uncertain. And I remember feeling like, I do not want to do what she's about to do. I don't want her to commit this act. And as soon as she did, I was like, I don't want to play her. I'm done. I don't want to play. I disagree. This is so bad. And then the second I felt that way, I was no longer playing her. And I was playing a brand new character who I had assumptions about. And then in playing through her story, I felt very different. Now, certainly there are other works of fiction that have examined the antagonist and examined the protagonist, and you feel different ways. But I think are the more curt and pat entries compared to the way what this examines. It's not just, and I definitely felt the way you did at times, Dave. When it first started out, I said, "Oh, is this the point? Is this what this is? This is all this is going to be?" I know this hour one into the game, I get the point already. Do I really need to keep going? But as I kept going, it kept on saying more and more nuanced things about that experience and giving me perspective on things like nothing else, you know, is able to give, not just because of the medium, but also just because of the really well written storytelling. So I in the one hand understand your perspective, but I think it, the way you summed it up, it's like you could, like any biopic, you could sum up like, oh, this kind of thing, is any genre could be summed up that way. But it's about the details of it and how they're expressed. And I think that this game says so many things along the way. I kept thinking too more, because certainly the revenge story, yes, and about hate. But I kept examining like justification, like it's about what is morally just. Like I kept trying to track the morality of what I was doing. Like, is this okay? Am I still in the right here? And then when I switched characters, I felt, well, is this okay? Is this the right thing to be doing here? And I certainly came out at the end feeling like I could not believe the moment that Ellie was the boss. That the fact that the boss of the scene, the boss of the sequence, the big boss is Ellie. And I loved that because at that point I was so much more connected to Abby, and really do feel like she is, I feel, and I could be wrong and my memory isn't perfect, and I'd be happy to hear a different interpretation, but I really felt like Ellie did one heinous, but I think completely justified thing in killing Joel, what's that?
Abby did that. You said Ellie. Abby.
My bad, Abby. I'm sure that won't be the first time I do that. And Joel is, if we did not have the first game's perspective on his character, if we were only ever in anyone else's shoes, you would think he would get the death penalty. He would be gone. He does not deserve to live after doing what he did. Though the first game gave you empathy for that action. But Ellie killed him, spared other people, and then the rest of the game, if memory serves, she keeps on sparing. We keep on worrying that she's going to exact revenge, but she keeps on sparing. And Ellie, if memory serves, keeps on not sparing. I keep on hoping that she would have made the choices that Abby makes, and unfortunately she does. She kept on allowing herself to giving into the dark side, giving into the hate, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think that one of the reasons why, and I sense a lot of pushback from like reducing the game down to very simplistic message, right? And I understand that. I guess for me, the game never went beyond the simplistic. The reason I think a lot of critics are saying the theme is like violence is bad or whatever is because I don't, in my opinion, I didn't see that nuance there, right? I didn't see the nuance that you describe of this is revealing more details. It's peeling back the layers of what it means. And it's just like, well, yes, I get that playing from a different perspective, the perspective of the character that killed Joel is a radical decision. Like it is, they're taking a big swing there. And I appreciate that just like for the ambition of it. And I think like a significant part of it worked, but you understand, hey, yes, I do get that. Like you are, when you see things from the perspective of your enemy, like they actually have really legitimate reasons for doing what they're doing. But at the end of the day, I don't know that it went fully beyond that. I actually think that Abby, like you said, probably has like a more interesting arc in this game than Ellie does. It really boils down to this thing about ludonarrative dissonance, though. I don't know if you guys saw this piece by Chris Plant that he published at Polygon today, but it really summed up my feelings on this game, which is that ludonarrative dissonance, for those who don't know, is the idea that sometimes the way you play, what your character does, may be different than the tone or message of the game that you're playing. Best example of that being Naughty Dog's game itself, like Uncharted, where I think the body count in Uncharted 1 is 1,000. Like Nathan Drake murders 1,000 dudes in that game. But it's like a very cheery, he's a happy go lucky, funny guy who's like punning on everything. Very, very Kanata esque figure, if I may. Only with like just like 10% maybe more killings than Jeff Kanata in real life.
I think that puts me at 100 deaths, Dave. I think you've just pinned 100 deaths on me.
Yeah, at least. But what this game does is rather than evolve the gameplay, right, which is very, very similar to what it was like when Last of Us 1 came out in 2013, rather than evolve the gameplay, the story has changed to fit how violent the game is, right? You're still killing the same number of people. It's still like super dark like the first game is. But now the game is like, well, this is what a person would actually be like if they killed 1,000 people, right? They would be almost completely irredeemable.
Are you comparing this to the first Last of Us or to Uncharted? I got mixed up.
Both a little bit. I'm saying like this, rather than change the gameplay so that it is less focused on killing, right? This game is like, let's keep the killing the same and bring the story to the place where it's as dark as what 1,000 killings would entail. Because this game is super, super dark, right? Yeah. And there's nothing inherently wrong with that. It's just, for me, less interesting than, you know, the story of the first game. And also, the game, I just think, is super relentless. Like, it uses 25 hours to make its point when literally 12 hours would have sufficed. So anyway, that's kind of my thoughts on that.
I do agree with that very last thing you said, and I've thought about this quite a bit while playing, is that I think, you know, my criticisms of the game, the things that I didn't love, are all sort of, can all be tracked back to the amount of game that it is. You know, if the excess... Like, you get the point. I mean, if it was just the cutscenes and then some of the stuff in between, not the hours of stuff in between those story points. And there's lots of great, I don't want to minimize, there's lots of great story in the gameplay itself as well. But if that was 1 6-hour experience, the story would, or however long it would need to be, I don't know, you know, but like the story would not suffer at all. And I think a lot of the feelings of, but this is too much, I don't want to see this much, I'm doing, you know, all of those things start to go away. It could still be making its point about all of that,
right,
without quite the amount, which is just, it's the reckoning of the format, with the reckoning of needing an amount of gameplay to warrant AAA release or whatever, you know, I imagine, I assume.
Yeah. I have a couple thoughts on that, actually, but I want to, we have not given any time for Chris to speak yet, but I want to respond to that at some point.
Christian, do you have anything to say about this?
So for people, depending on where you're listening to this, who don't know, you know, call me biased. I'm hosting the official Last of Us podcast. We're talking about part two starting in July. If you listen to DLC, hopefully, you know, I'm a huge fan of the series, and the fact that I'm working on a thing with Sony and Naughty Dog, I honestly feel like does not change my opinions here, but
I want to say great podcast. I listen to it every week. I'm super psyched for you to get to the second game. So
likewise, thank you. Yeah, there's some fun stuff. So all those caveats out of the way, I love the game. Sorry, Half-Life Alyx. It's my favorite of the year, surprise. And I think it's about so much more than just that revenge. I think if anything, the marketing maybe planted that seed in people's heads, and because that's what they kind of were allowed to talk about, maybe. And it's like, oh, violence, violence, violence. That's what this is. And to me, it's so much more than that, right? It's humanity and what makes us human and what keeps us connected and all of the complex emotions that go into being a human. And I think, you know, Dave, to your point about like, well, they made a story to match the world. I don't think so. To me, I feel like this is a very bold and fascinating story that wasn't the safe sequel, but took these characters to a place that I think really does justice to the first game of putting them in uncomfortable situations where there is no right or wrong. You know, there's a bunch of gray. Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? Like, it's a complex world where these characters are on the razor's edge of emotions all the time and being pushed into these scenarios that are just horrific for anyone to think about. And I think to your and Dan's point, I think the length is very effective. And I think that, you know, us and several other people that play a lot of games and consume a lot of media, it's like, oh, I got the point. I can get the point in 6 hours. And it's like, there's, in my opinion, there's a difference between getting the point and feeling it. And I use the analogy of the Metal Gear Solid 4, the radiation scene a lot in that, of like, this is what games can do. And you feel it. And Edith Finch has moments like that too, where you're engaging in the story in a way that has you feel it. And I think you living these characters' worlds for as long as you do makes an emotional connection with you, the player, that it wouldn't the same way as a shorter experience. I'm not saying there's no fat that couldn't be trimmed. Of course there probably is. But I really found my time with Abby and Ellie to all of it to be worthwhile. And there were times when I started, I was like, oh, Abby, I don't know about this. I don't know about this. And then it's like, you come around and I start to really empathize with her. And I think it's a very bold choice for a sequel. And I was just constantly blown away by what it did narratively. And then we're not even talking about like the technical marvel that I think the game is. Like, yeah. This is the story discussion for spoilers.
I think we're all on the same page about the technical marvel.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a small analogy, and then I'll be quiet for a little bit, but it's just like, and this is one of the characters whose names I forget, and that bothers me right now in this moment, but like just the symmetry of the dog, right? And it's like Ellie kills it and she's like, damn dogs. And then it's like Abby, it's like Ace, and just seeing that, just that is like such a microcosm of an example of what humanity is and what it means to empathize with someone else and what their situation is and what it can be. And what you think of as this is something totally different to someone else, and what kind of world that builds and establishes, and what are the consequences of that, and how can we have influence over what type of world we want to live in? I think if anything, the game's about empathy and humanity than it is more about violence and revenge.
It's interesting, Dave, that you framed this part of the discussion in terms of ludonarrative dissonance, because I felt that the game really takes that on in a way that I don't know any other game that does. I mean, a lot of people have talked about Spec Ops: The Line, kind of, but I feel like this game is accepting
the reality of ludonarrative dissonance in game design and asking you to consider it, asking you to live inside it. I killed a whole lot of clickers and infested in this game. I attempted to kill as few human beings as I could. I have never had a video game make me feel the desire to not kill as much as this game did. And yes, it's a video game where you have choice in those sequences to tackle the challenge as you may. And yes, you are faced with a series of enemies that you have to get past, and you have the opportunity to kill them. You can kill them, and Christian has said many times he had fun playing it. I did not. I did not have fun killing human beings in this game because I bought into the mental state of the characters that I was portraying.
I bought into the mental state too. Ellie turned around. Ellie went back. No one was standing. It wasn't me being like, "Wee!" It was, no, forget them.
Yeah, and I felt like it was not fun for me to slit the throat of a human being. Watching, you could, take the camera around anytime you did a stealth kill and see the face of Ellie or Abby doing that and how anguished they were. I mean, I feel like this game makes great pains to show how despicable an act each of those is. Mm-hmm. And I also think that what no one really ever brings up when they talk about this game, there's a lot of talk about Ellie and Abby and Joel and the revenge idea and the hate built in. But no one brings up the tapestry upon which that story plays out. The background that is so filled out in this game. You are literally in the middle of a human on human war by the end of this game. You are galloping through hell in a war between people that are all trying to survive the apocalypse, and you'd think pooling their resources would be pretty smart and helpful. And yet here they are slaughtering each other by the dozens in this horrible scene. And throughout the entire game, throughout the entire experience, it is all about factions and who are we killing and who's killing who. And so much of Abby's playthrough is her turning on the very people that she has this brotherhood, sisterhood with. And throughout all of it, I felt like I can't hurt these people. Yes, there is this sect that is dangerous and scary. And those whistles, I will never not be freaked out when I hear those whistles. It's such an effective thing. And yet you then meet people from that sect and you go, oh, they're decent people in the sect too. You know, it's like it's this cult that is scary. Well,
the people that are breaking out of the sect are decent people, but yes.
Yeah, well, they were once in it, right? And their mother was in it and dies because of it. And all of it is complex. All of it is subtle. All of it is shades of gray. And I think that tapestry that this game builds is compelling to me in the sense that I don't feel like any of it is pat. I don't feel like any of it is easy. All of it makes me go, oh my God, I want to do as little awful as I can in this game. And it forces you to do some awful. And that's something that we can talk about, but
yeah,
I don't know.
So a few thoughts on what you said.
Can I just add one tidbit anecdote to your point you're making about the confronting of violence? I agree with everything you just said, Jeff, but there's a moment in the very beginning in the sort of tutorial-y section when it's teaching you to like the art of pushing into through small crevices, and a frozen body pops out, and you have to then like push through that body to progress. That felt like that's the metaphor. That's the game. Yeah. That's the whole thing, which was is such an authored moment. That is something that did not have to happen. It could teach you to progress through crevices without that. I think it's telling you right up front, you're going to have to confront human faces. It's not just monsters, and it's not just guys in Uncharted, guys in helmets with bodysuits on that you don't, like this is like you're pushing through a human that looks very well rendered, and push past it if you can. I thought that was a very early sign of what the game was trying to do. That was very different than it's just a game, have fun. And I felt very much a commentary on other video games, especially ones that they've made themselves.
So a few thoughts. Number one, the point about ludonarrative dissonance, I just want to be clear, is in case it's not clear, what this game does is it eliminates a lot of ludonarrative dissonance, right? Because it has shaped the story around the main actions of the protagonists, which is mostly centered around killing, right? Or you know, trying to avoid killing, but mostly killing. And game developers want to tell epic stories, but they also want the gameplay to match what the story is. And that's what this game does, in my opinion, right? It is the logical endpoint of trying to eliminate the gulf between the gameplay and the story, which is you tell the story about how extremely effed up it would be if somebody did have to kill 1,000 people. What would that actually do to someone's psyche? And you do kind of explore that in this game. I want to say a couple things about something that Dan said earlier, right? Like, one is that, in my opinion, I mean, first of all, I'm really enjoying talking about this game with you guys. And I think that what's clear to me is that the things that I thought were weaknesses are what you guys think are strengths. Right. And that's just I think it's just it's fascinating how it's like in the eye of the beholder and who's viewing the game, you know, that the same exact thing the game does can be viewed by me as a weakness and you guys as a strength. But I think that like in storytelling in general, you don't want the audience to be ahead of the storyteller. Right. Like, I think you want the audience, the storyteller is like pressing forward and you're like the audience, you're like trying to catch up. You're like, oh my gosh, what is going to happen next? Whereas I think the length of the game, to the point of length earlier, I think really does hurt this game because I feel like I'd already gotten the points that the game was trying to make, you know, several hours into LA storyline. For more of the game than not, I was like, Ellie, this is extremely self-destructive and bad. You shouldn't be doing this. But the game is forcing me to do it. And so I feel like I'm ahead of the game for much of the game's playtime. And I think a lot of critics felt that way as well. And that's a big source of frustration.
Do you not feel that way about Kill Bill?
I was going to say Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, I mean, most things, you know?
Or Hamlet.
Okay, I mean Hamlet, that's a good. Okay, you got me with the Hamlet, Jeff. That's fair enough. I cannot dispute with the Hamlet.
I like that, like, yeah. That's a universal truth.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, Hamlet is basically like,
I cannot come back from that one. I cannot come back from
because that's it, a good one. I mean, yeah, that's what I brought up on Alana Pierce's show too, and everybody was like, "You can't compare a piece of literature to a video game," and I was like, "That's not literature." Okay, whatever.
okay, no, but that's fair. That's fair. Is that there are many cases in which it's possible to be ahead of the in which the audience is ahead of the story, and that's okay, right? And like the craft of what is happening is so good that it doesn't matter. And maybe this is one of those cases for a lot of people, right?
But there were several things I don't have to be in your house while you played to know. There must have been several moments of this game that were stunning and surprising and you could never have seen coming.
Yeah, that's true. I actually wanted to get to those, but let me just say one other thing, which is I want to ask you this question, Dan Trachtenberg. Okay. And I think it's
good talking to you. I'll see you later.
I remember reading like Alan Moore talk about Watchmen, right? And they were making Watchmen into a movie, and Alan Moore, the creator of Watchmen and many other beloved comics, really did not like that. And so to this day, he refuses to watch it.
He refuses to do a lot of things, though, to be fair.
Right. Yeah. But he said something like, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I think it's pretty close, is that like, I did not write Watchmen to be made into a movie. In many ways, I wrote Watchmen as a comic to show what comics could do that movies could not do, right? And that always stuck with me ever since. But I want to ask you this question, Dan. Picture this. You're making a movie. Let's say it's called 10 Cloverfield Lane. There's a character in it played by a very talented actress, Mary Elizabeth Winstead. She's about to break out of this crazy bunker. And she finally gets out. It's like you've been waiting the whole movie for this extremely tense, fraught moment for her to bust out of this high stress situation.
Are we spoiling 10 Cloverfield Lane too?
I am spoiling 10 Cloverfield Lane.
The madness.
But not Last of Us Part 1.
But not Last of Us Part 1, that's right. She emerges from the bunker, smash cut to the beginning of the movie, and then you experience the entire thing from John Goodman's perspective. I don't think anyone would ever do that. And it is an incredibly frustrating storytelling decision, in my opinion, to just like you're at the height of like, oh my gosh, the entire game has been building to this point, and then smash cut to I'm viewing the thing from the other perspective, and also I'm restarting 3 days ago.
You know who does do that, Dave?
That's not what the game's building to.
Wait, but there's so many.
Yeah, a lot of people attacking me at once.
At the same time.
Have at me. Go ahead.
I have comments about 10 Cloverfield Lane. I am the most qualified person here to talk about 10 Cloverfield Lane.
I bought a ticket to that movie not to watch it. I bought a ticket to show the realities of what buying a ticket to a movie can mean, not to watch a movie about it.
Jeff, I just want to say, because I want to hear.
You know what does do that?
Tell me.
George R. R. Martin.
Yeah, so I was going to say TV, Game of Thrones, Breaking
and
Bad.
That ended super well.
I'm talking about the books.
Dave, that's a very I don't understand. I mean, you're comparing if this game did that on hour 20, I think we'd all be a little bit like, geez, Louise. But it doesn't. I think comments about amount aside, like it does all that stuff at a very appropriate amount of time, given the breadth of the game and the breadth of games of its genre and games in general.
You know what else kind of does that? Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, so many things, so many great works, and including this one. That was, I thought, what incredible. And by the way,
my experience. Wait. Go ahead. Sorry, Dan.
What I thought was a really genius call is you start the game with Abby. So it's not like – that's like starting the thing where you think John Goodman's the protagonist, and then you switch to Marilyn's – I don't even want to talk about this that way. But also, I will say, too, talk about being ahead of the narrative that, you know, in the trailers for 10 Cloverfield Lane, it shows her running around outside, and the big question of the movie is, will she be outside or not? Will she make it outside? What's outside? And what I think is hopefully rewarding about the experience is that the steps, the nuances along the way are surprising. It's not just what is the end surprising, and the end is, you know, crazy in a different way. But
well, I understand a lot of you think my analogy is bad, and I should feel bad, and that's okay.
Hey, I've been there, buddy.
You've been there, Joe. I think that. And some people in the chat room, we're broadcasting this live, are saying like, it's a different medium. And I'm pretty sure I made exactly that point and gave that huge caveat right before, you know, with the Alan Moore thing.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter what I said 3 minutes ago, but I acknowledge that it is different. But I think that like, it would be different if, you know, you're watching Pulp Fiction and then one of the segments is, you know, 10 hours long. Like,
Dave, real quick.
Sorry. And that's not the culmination. That's Abby killing Joel is the inciting incident. The conclusion is Ellie and Abby on the beach in Santa Barbara. That's what it builds to, and that happens at the end. The timeline of when things happen, one, that does happen chronologically later, but the fact that you see the death scene early and then jump back into earlier moments of that, that's still the flashpoint for this story, right? Because it's a culmination of Abby's training, getting her to this point to do this thing, and Ellie's culmination of her story of who she is, having meaning, having a point, having family, having all of these things, right? And so that's the match being lit, but that's not the end of that game or the story. So to me, it doesn't seem like they start at the end and then flash you around. The end is that fight.
Well,
That you just did not like playing what you like? Last of Us is a very pure story, and this is a very complicated. By the way, I think Godfather to Godfather 2 is like one of the most apt comparisons to the two games. But what you're saying is that you just did not enjoy having to go back and play Abby.
I'm interrogating my own feelings on it.
Copy
live publicly, which is that like I'm super engrossed. I was actually like pretty engrossed in the game at that point, right? I'm like, oh, what's gonna happen? We're reaching this moment, and then for the game to just take a 10-hour detour,
Can I tell you my experience of reading every Game of Thrones book, all of the Song of Ice and Fire,
yes,
is what you're describing. That's my experience of reading those books. You are in a chapter and you're like, oh my God, this is insane. And you get up to a point and they're about to cut Ned Stark's head off.
Yeah.
And you're like, did they cut it off? And it goes, new chapter. Here's a new person somewhere else on the planet doing something else. And you're like, what? When do we get back to this? When do we get? I want to find, is Ned alive? Is he dead? What's going on? We were in the perspective of his daughter and I think she saw him dead, but she hid her eyes at the last second. And I don't know if he's alive or dead. All I care about is whether he's, go back to this, go back to this. And then because it's a book, I read the next page, which is the new chapter, and I go, God, I do not want to be reading about this person. I don't care about this person right now. All I care about is where we just were. Why are we here? And then 15 pages into that chapter, I'm like, all I give a shit is about this person. Oh my God. And we get to the end of that chapter and he leaves it on a cliffhanger there. And I go, no, I don't want to leave this. This is the one thing I care about most. And that is the entire process of reading those books for me. And so I very much understood what was happening in this game where you get to this point where all you care about is what is Ellie going to do when she finally sees Abby and the game goes, nope, here's information you need before you can even process that moment. And so it goes, it puts you in this other perspective. And now when you get back to that moment, when you're outside that theater in the rain and you know exactly what's going on inside that theater, you have more information than the characters you're playing do. And you go, I know what's at stake. I know who I am to those people. I know what's about to happen when I break in. To me, it is so much richer, so much more interesting. It's fucking Back to the Future. You know, it's like, it's, oh my God, now I know the other side. I know what's going on, what's at stake outside this experience for all these other sides of the prism. And that's exactly what I think that the point of what the game is doing. It's not saying, hey, you know, I just want to go and, you know, extend the length of this experience. It's trying to show you, hey, you don't have enough information to even contextualize this moment yet.
Jeff, what that moment... I remember just being so floored as that was progressing. And of course, it's something that is inevitable. And also, moments like that in Pulp Fiction, moments like that in other movies where now we're seeing it from another character, Rashomon, right? But in this format, knowing that location so intimately because of the way I experienced it through one character's shoes, and then exploring it as somebody else,
you have to break into the game. Yeah. Doesn't let you just walk in. You have to like break into that place that you've walked into so many times. It's so powerful.
And you're so connected. Okay. You're so connected to that person at that time and knowing what might and hoping that it doesn't, but using the knowledge of like what you had already done in the other, that's something that movies can't provide. I guess books can, but and shows sometimes do, but not you just don't, you're not as connected. And Dave, the thing that the one criticism I have of the game, was that the ending made me feel like, oh, well, the way I experienced the ending, which it was not actually, which we can get to, but
it made me feel like PS4 died with like 2 hours left in the game. Like what happened?
It made me feel like, oh, this was Ellie's story and Abby was just in it. And up until that moment, what I was loving was that, oh, no, this is the story of these two characters.
Yeah.
And it sounds like your criticism was you thought you were playing Ellie's game and now suddenly you have to play another character. And what I relished in was that I felt way more connected to Abby and her story, and was sort of sad that the conclusion didn't, and I did not stick around for the end credits and the game menu screen to know that actually there was a really elegant, poetic, profound way to conclude. And if I had that moment, I would have felt very differently, and I would have nailed me. I unfortunately learned after the fact about that.
That was pretty good. You're referring to like the boat on the shore at the end, yes?
The boat on the shore with the Santa Barbara landmarks.
No.
Catalina.
It's Catalina.
Catalina. I know.
Catalina.
Sorry.
Yeah. But that it's a very, I thought it was very beautiful, actually.
Yeah, the way I found that out was days later, a friend of mine texted me. We were talking about the moment, and he sent me a video of his screen playing the game, and he panned to the menu screen he had just finished, and he panned over to a poster on his wall of Catalina with that build. Like, he happens to have a friggin' poster on his wall, and so I can't imagine his like realization of like, oh my God. And I just didn't unfortunately have it in real time.
Just to articulate explicitly what you're saying is that like the implication of the menu screen that you get after the game is over is that Abby makes it to the Fireflies location, right? So
and
it's a very beautiful, elegant way of doing it. I agree.
Her story.
So
I think that's a big, I think back in all the criticisms I've been reading of the game and watching of the game, I feel like so much of it is they thought that people wanted Joel and Ellie's story and that's what they were going to get, and they got something different. And it wasn't quite what they had wanted. Didn't really meet the game on its own terms, I guess.
Yeah. Clarifying a couple of things. First of all, Jeff, I think our plan for you to moderate and take some heat off me from people who love the game is going super well.
You're welcome.
But secondly, I think that number one, I think like there's a couple parts to my feelings on it, which is one, I'm super engrossed in this Ellie storyline, and then all of a sudden cutting away, and I guess I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with that. I think you guys are right about that, right? Like, there's many stories and you know, TV shows and books or whatever that have done that, and it's been like it's worked out. But I think like when you're talking about Game of Thrones, you're talking about like the execution is so ridiculously good, right? That it makes you marvel at the craft, right? And there's certainly like really good craft to be found in this game as well, but I don't know that on a storytelling perspective it's quite as complex and rich as a Game of Thrones to make it worth the detour justifiable for me personally. For other people it may be, right?
Yeah, that's to me kind it's not a detour. Like that's the road, you know? Like, and I, at least for me, it's like, yeah, I reacted to playing as Abby, to now playing again as this character who I just, you know, had witnessed brutally murder someone I'd spent 18 hours with or whatever it was in the first game, and Joel, and have heard these horrible things about, you know, from Ellie's perspective and the things they've done, and learning about the WLF and kind of what this life is, and like as you go through the city in Seattle and you see these people that try to survive outside of the WLF's protection and what they did to them, and you know, it really paints this picture. And then to get that, like, it's just like a, you know, you're ripped away from that, and you're the controls in your hand, and you're playing Abby, and you're playing who's been painted as this, as the villain or as the antagonist. It, again, I think it's something that's beautiful about the medium, where I have to push forward. I have to engage with this character that I don't like, but I think by design. And I need to push her story forward versus like a TV show. It happens, you know, a book. Yeah, you got to turn the page. But here, I have to do it. I have to interact with this game and push this character forward, and in doing so, help her achieve her goals, and goals that initially I'm not sure if I'm on board with. And then as I spend time as her, you know, you learn about her character, why she's done the things she's done, how, I think Dan said this earlier, how it's like, well, maybe she's better than Ellie, because you've already done a bunch of horrible things as Ellie. Yeah. And you're there. She stops Ellie from, you know, being killed in the first place, her and Tommy. And she steps in there, but you don't hear what she says as Ellie's perspective too, which I think is brilliant and beautiful, because you are Ellie in that moment. Like, the blood is ringing in your ears. You're not dialed in and listening. And so I think the way it plays with perspective, and this isn't the Outer Worlds, this isn't Fallout, right? This isn't, you know, Christian adventuring in world. This is their story. And the fact that it is these character stories, but I'm interacting with it and still have to have agency to push it forward, is so emotionally compelling. And now listening to this conversation, I think you guys are right. I think I'm going to go buy this game. It sounds fun.
I mean, that's really why we are here, to make sure that Christian maybe plays this or tries it, you know?
He was on the fence for the entire recording session of the podcast, and now we finally pushed him over the edge. I guess I just want to make clear that I don't think that it's inherently wrong to switch to another character's perspective. And I actually agree, it's quite subversive. I think that just it's really the execution, right? It's really just the length of the amount of time you spend as that character, and what you spend doing as that character, right? Which I know for you guys, you don't feel this way about it, but for me, it really did feel kind of like a side quest. Theoretically, you're finding out more about like what this character is going. She is having the most consequential, important days of her life at the same time as Ellie is, right? She is going through this thing where she's like saving these people, realizing that all that she believed was a lie. It didn't quite work for me at the level, because you have 15 hours up on Ellie than you do on Abby. You know, like you just have so much more connection with her that you've built up through the first game, and so for me it just didn't quite work at the same level. And I know I'm gonna get completely torched by our listeners for this review. I just want to make sure I'm torched for the right reasons, you know?
Oh, I doubt that. I think there's plenty of people in your camp. I've certainly heard from them, but the from a purely motivational standpoint, I'm much more on it. I thought this was Abby's game. I really related much more to Abby than Ellie, because from Abby's perspective, your dad is going to save the fucking world. I guess I can't say that because we're on DLC. Your dad.
You've sworn a lot already, Jeff. Just go with it. You're editing it. Just let it go.
Yeah, I'll do it. Your dad is going to save the world. And not only is that prevented, I mean, literally every day after that moment that you have to go through hell in this post-apocalyptic nightmare hellscape, you feel like this doesn't need to be happening right now.
Every friend person, that's turned, yes.
Every single person that gets bitten and dies, every single moment, plus your dad, whom you love, is gone. Yes, I would want to destroy that person too. I would feel like that is the worst crime against humanity that anyone could do. It's so much worse than what Abby does, in my opinion.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. And one of the things about the game that I think, you know, I've been spending a lot of time talking about what I don't like, but one of the things I like about the game is how it brings forth this idea of duality, right? Like the ads for this game are about duality, right? You see, there's this really beautiful, I haven't stopped listening to this cover of True Faith that plays in the commercial for this game. It's the Lottie Kester version, slightly different, but you see her playing guitar and she's kind of there with Dina, and then it cuts to her about to like take out a bunch of scars, right? And it's like, oh, the same person can love someone else deeply and also murder a bunch of dudes, right? And you see like, revenge takes these two characters along these very different paths. Ellie is physically very scrawny and skinny, and Abby is quote unquote built like an ox, as the game describes, right? Abby is afraid of heights. Ellie wants to go to space, you know, like, and you kind of, there's this really interesting mirroring between the two of them. Like Abby actually takes the good path, right? She gets all that revenging out of her bones, and then she's like, I'm done. I don't need to kill the brother and the kid. You know, I'm done. And Ellie can't let it go until it completely consumes her. And I like that. I like the way I like that, you know, the game is kind of bringing those mirror images to life in this way. So
to me, one of the things that I find so surprising about the post-release discussion of this game, mm-hmm. and is, in my opinion, a compliment to the game, is that all the conversations are the conversations that we've been having. All of the conversations. And to me, that's what great art is. No one has been talking about the like straight up dozen incredible action sequences and set piece moments that this game delivers that are
as good as anything Naughty Dog has ever done, as good as anything any video game has ever done, just
any movie, anything, any story. I mean,
yeah, there are so many incredible set pieces. I haven't heard anyone talk about them, right? Because the narrative is so compelling and so divisive and so challenging. It is a, you talk about video games being challenging, and it's a problematic term because it's so easily misinterpreted as being difficult to complete or something like that, you know, a dexterity challenge. When this game is challenging in the ways that we've been talking about, is how do you feel about this? What do you think of these people? Do you agree with what you're forced to do? And because that is such a strong element and is so powerfully expressed and forces you to make those, have those thoughts, so much of what makes it just an incredible video game piece of work, like a craft in the analog of video games, is completely overlooked. It's amazing.
Also, to add to that, I think so much of the conversation centers around Abby and Ellie as they are, you know, main figures of the game. But, you know, I could do a whole nother hour about Tommy and about Dina and how they're fleshed out and realized and what they add to this story, right? Like, it's, I mean, there's
Owen and Mel.
There's
and,
the beautiful yeah. line of Dina when they're back at the farm towards the end. And it's like, you know, I'm paraphrasing, and Ellie's like, you know, you're fine with all this, but I'm not. And she's like, you think I'm fine? Like, you know, how dare you? I just don't let this, you know, Dina's been without a family since she was 10. Like, she, it kind of felt like a nice mirror moment back to Last of Us Part One, when Joel, it's like the beautiful moment, Joel kind of claps back at Ellie and he's like, you're not my daughter. You don't know what loss is. And Ellie's like, everyone I've loved has been taken from me. And then we see that in Left Behind. And here we're getting this moment of Ellie having that with Dina. She's like, you don't understand. You don't know what it's like. And Dina's like, I don't know what it's like. Jesse's dead. Everyone I've ever loved has died. My family was ripped away from me at a very young age. You're going the wrong way, Ellie. This isn't right. And Ellie's like, I have to do this. And
George Lucas would be proud, because it rhymes.
But can we talk about that? There's several awesome things that Jeff, you made a freaking great point about the conversations about this game, and they're not even including the things that we normally talk about in video games. But I would, because you just brought up the farm, like that sunset house that like Andrew Wyeth inspired. Yeah. It is one of the most gorgeous places I've been to.
Photorealistic, I would argue.
I would love to spend, I wish I had that as a, like a mini game that like Flower or whatever that I could just like spend time in.
Why can't it needs to be an Airbnb is what it needs to be.
But also a genius, first of all, like the fact that the game does that is unreal. It reminded me of the like Battlestar Galactica, like 3 years later, like the fact that that's what it, you know, where it goes linearly is amazing. But that sequence was so filled with, on the one hand, beauty, but so much tension for me. I wonder if you guys had the same experience of like, oh no, don't be a dream sequence. Please don't be a dream sequence. And it keeps going, you go, and then you're like, oh no, like, oh, thank God it's not a dream sequence. And then you're like, oh no, wait, I hope it's a dream sequence. Like, oh no, is it a nightmare sequence? Like, I just never quite felt. And then I was like, oh,
the part where you have to go outside with the baby and rustle up the sheep. I'm like, oh, this is definitely a dream sequence. Right. Oh no.
Right.
Yeah.
And then
it's
like, oh no, it's not gonna be a dream sequence, but something bad's really gonna happen in reality. Like, and then you just remarkable. Also, Jeff, as you mentioned, set pieces, like there's this truck sequence in, I don't know which portion of the game.
I was wondering, can we just talk about like favorite sequences? I think that might be.
Yeah. Like that.
So many.
There's so many that I think equals or rivals Children of Men or Let Me In. Like, it's such an incredible, I looked at it again today.
Which sequence are you referring to, Dan? Is it the one where they're like being attacked and Jesse's driving the vehicle?
Yes. Jesse's driving the vehicle. By the way, I mentioned I should have said up front too, like Christian, I'm friends with people at Naughty Dog. I know Neil Druckmann. And so you know, feel free to not care about what I say because it would be seem biased or whatever. But I think like I texted him, like John Woo is to Doves what Neil Druckmann is to trucks. every game he's worked on has had an incredible truck sequence.
Yeah, it's true.
And this like takes the cake now. It's not and watching it back is cool. But it just makes me just anyone who's ever talked to me about, you know, video games, having an opinion on video games and they don't play a game, they watch people play them or, you know, like it is watching that back is as thrilling as a movie would be. But playing it when you are like I wasn't breathing during that scene and trying to make a shot while the car's doing what it's doing. And then the surprise of Jesse stabbing the thing and the door closing and slamming the guy, like just there's so many details that it didn't have to have and it still would be very good. Then it has those details that are just like, wow, this is masterful storytelling. And I felt the same thing revisiting that sequence that I'd forgotten about was in the teaser from a couple of years ago, the long oneer of Abby being choked and when you meet Yara and Lev,
oh,
I guess.
Yeah.
But that sequence is, if that were in a movie, it would be nominated for, I mean, like that was the most
And then perfect. Following that, when you're running through the dark, that whole sequence of running through the forest at night and they drop the torch and you have to fight a couple of times. It's like,
God, yes.
Oh,
yes.
I mean, if we're talking favorite scenes for me, it's hands down, the Tommy pursuing Tommy across the bridge.
Yes. I was going to say too.
You're sniping. He's sniping
to sequence. Yeah.
Bring that
infected to you the whole, and then it throws a curveball.
Did you know it was him the whole time?
That's the thing. I didn't know it was him. And then, you, when you realize it's, you're like, because you're playing and you're like, F this guy, I hate this freaking guy.
Yes.
And then you finally catch
that's
up and you realize,
the game, Dave. I know, that's yeah. the whole
I just
point.
Want to say, yeah. like, isn't that, that's something that you cannot, that A is not, oh, I knew the game was going to do that the whole time. And it's not just trite, like, oh, revenge, I get it, revenge is bad. And you don't get it in Kill Bill or any other movie, Payback, or a movie about revenge and eye for an eye, or a Pulp Fiction movie that plays with perspective. You don't get those moments where you are feeling frustrated about this antagonist and want to take care of them. And then the second that you realize who that person, it's like, and they kill your butt. Like, and you're like, it's what a profound experience to give to people to have that, you know? There's nothing like that.
I think what I'm trying to make clear, right, is that there are many sequences from the game that I loved. And, like, I wish the game had more of that kind of stuff. Right? You know, I didn't – the whole Abby side quest thing, that's the thing that I – it's really
that
honestly
was
like
the side
like
– That was a part of the side quest, though.
I know, but it's like
– I just don't think it's a side quest.
No, I know. I know how you guys feel about it. I mean, I think that the thing that I was going to say was my favorite sequence, honestly, is – early on when you play as Abby, this is before Seattle even happens. And you're playing as Abby and, there's this whole sequence where like you're crawling through this gap between this fence and this shack and the infected are just like reaching at you. And it's just like, you're like freaking terrified. They're grabbing things off of your person. And then one of the infected like comes through the fence and like attacks you and it's on top of you. And then all of a sudden, Joel comes out of nowhere, executes the infected. And then you're like running away from there's this huge chase sequence with the thing. You're running away and you realize like it was this great kind of unsettling feeling because you have a feeling that Abby's like going after Joel, but you're not 100% sure. And then when you realize that is in fact the case, it's horrifying. That whole sequence of events and how that played out, I thought was awesome. So that was kind of that was early on in the game. So I love that part.
Yeah, very early enough that you kind of forget how amazing those moments are by the time you are, you know, survive the end of this game. Dan, I'm struck by your comparison. Again, I get in trouble for comparing things to other things, but I'm struck by your comparison to The Godfather because I think it is a very good comparison because, Dave, it's a bit like you saying, hey, I'm so excited for the sequel to The Godfather to find out more about Michael Corleone. Why are we spending all this time on Vito Corleone? I don't care about that. You know, it's like that's what Godfather 2 did. It's like, oh, half the movie is about Vito and Vito's story.
I just think, again, I have no issue with that. Love Godfather 2. I do think it's a different thing when instead of half a movie, it's half a 25-hour game. That's all I'm saying. For me, just like it's really like the excess of the game that I took issue with, and finding the game like exhausting in many ways, as opposed to in concept. I am not saying in concept you should not have put me in the shoes of this other character. I actually really like that. But I just think it's the execution and the grueling nature of it, and the fact that like you need to murder so many people. And like I already get it. Like the revenge is bad. Like you don't need to keep killing these people. You know, put down just, the pipe, Abby.
I do agree with that. Because Tristan, you kind of mentioned something about this as well in defense of it, and I just want to point out that like I agree that the game does need length and breadth. Like it's why it's more comparable to a TV show than a movie. TV shows impact us in a certain way because of the length of time we spend with characters. And this game does need that and I love that it has time for the quiet moments and all those things.
Yeah.
It's not about my criticism about Amount that I think would solve not only Dave's criticisms, but many criticisms is more in the, amount of times I have to hit a button and I don't, and then I got to get a battery for it and then get a ladder and drag it over.
Right.
It's, which the game should have. It's just the amount of it all, that is, feels like shoe leathery, that is not informing. And then there's also, you know,
there's so many drawers I had to open that had nothing in them. Every time I opened a drawer, it had nothing in it. I was like, that's three seconds of my life.
I did find an interesting, because everything was so sparse and because the game was so emotionally affecting that I did scour more often than I would in a game where it's like finding an unlockable in a drawer, you know, like, you know, BioShock or something. Like I turn over every trash can. Like I really did feel the need to hope to find some tape or some, you know, something because it was in so, rare supply, you know.
I wonder, and I'm curious how games, or maybe how this game specifically or other games too, can tackle this. Because I'm curious too, Dave, for like how you played this game, like how many days, how quickly, how long were your play sessions? Where I know, like in TV, a lot of us binge. You know, it's sit down. Oh, I watched all of Succession in, you know, a day. And I think for me, a reason I kind of bounced off Game of Thrones early is that I got into it late and I watched like five seasons in a weekend, you know, like clearly I'm exaggerating, but I watched a lot of it and I was like, oh, I feel like I was watching The Matrix. And it was just like, introduce character, make me love character, kill character, introduce character, make me think character's good, learn character's bad, introduce character, make me love character, kill character, introduce. And I was just like, I can't not see what's, And I think a lot of us play video games like I got a weekend, you know, door closed, here we go, I'm playing this game. And I know that games have tried with like episodic and things like that. And I mentioned TV shows, people binge them, but they still have like end points. And this game has a lot of moments that do let you breathe. And I love so many of those moments in this game.
Yeah.
But nothing forces you to put the controller down. Like I don't want a Nintendo like, hey, you've been playing some emotionally traumatic stuff for an hour. Go for a walk. Like, I'm not looking for that.
Yeah.
But I do wonder, Dave. Like,
you watched Luigi beat...
Luigi just caved Mario's head in.
All of those people you killed are now ghosts. Luigi has to vacuum up. But, like, I do wonder if, you know, you were forced to put the controller down and, like, have a week between these things. Like, it doesn't feel like a burden. It's a... you're letting the emotion kind of wash over you. And I don't have an answer for that, but I did find myself like the circumstances in which I was playing the game. I wanted to experience all of it for this project I was working on and it had a very real deadline, but there were still moments, this project, that's so the podcast, the dumbest thing I've said. And I've said a lot of dumb things, but I was still, I was like, I got to put the controller down. I'm not going to barrel through this. Like I need to walk away. And then my last point, Jeff, I think for you, the lesson learned is you're only allowed to compare things to God of War. from now on. Like, you have to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Stay safe. Don't rile anybody up.
Direct comparisons to God.
I think that's a great point, Christian. You know, I think that if I had I basically played the whole thing within 48 hours.
See, that's brutal, man.
Yeah. So I think if I had played it a little bit.
You shotgunned this game.
I shotgunned it. Just like Abby shotgunned Joel's leg in the beginning of the game.
Yes.
The game was a shotgun, as Joel's leg.
Bit like, you know, shotgunning a whiskey or something. You know, it's a bit like.
Yeah.
It's an experience that I don't know it was necessarily intended for that. And I think a lot of people are. You know, a lot of people want to get through it. We talked about this on the Slash Filmcast.
Yeah.
About this idea of like not wanting to get spoiled and trying to get through it as fast as possible to ensure that it's a tricky thing.
But also,
I think I'm the opposite of you guys. I mean, it might be because of my poor memory, but I'm jealous of that experience, Dave, that like you got to, I think it was designed in a grand way, not in the nitty gritty of it, but in a grand way, it's a design to be, this is an experience in one breath. It's such a complete story. It's not episode. It's such a complete story. That I feel like you had the opportunity to have a really profound experience that when I play and put things down and stuff, like I think that was a part of why I felt a little unsatisfied in the end is I, unfortunately, my play session, which normally I would pay for like 2 hours every night, like I had wherever I had stopped on my last session, I only had an hour of play and then the game ended. And I was like, wait, what? That's not
right.
Just something felt wrong.
The game, you know, not that it should, I can't even imagine how it would do this as you indicated, Christian, but like the game does very little to guide you in terms of what the peaks and valleys of the story are, right? So yeah. I always was on edge. I was like, okay, should I take a break now? Maybe something extremely interesting is about to happen, right? And I don't want to miss it because I'm really in the zone right now with the game.
The other thing about the length for me was that, you know, we talk a lot about Ellie's story, Abby's story, the character stories. I was so fascinated by the world's story. I think the environmental storytelling in this game is unmatched. I mean, I've gone on at length about how much I love Bethesda's world storytelling, and there are other game companies and games that do it very well. This is on a completely other level, and it's because of the fidelity. It's because of the attention to detail. Every single thing in the world seems thought through and thought out. And you walk into a room and you immediately kind of understand the story of the people who lived there. You go into a place and you see how that place has broken down, what happened to it. For me, that was one of the benefits of the length, is that it was a lot of places to go and things to look at and things to see and so much detail.
Yeah, I really appreciated the segment in the Last of Us podcast plug in which they talk about this, right? Like they want to make sure every location tells a story about what happened there. Like you can look at it and understand the sequence of events that led to this happening. And I think because the graphics, the visuals are so good in the second game, it really takes it to another level in terms of what they're capable of doing there. I think also the level design in general,
exquisite.
It feels a lot less, or from a aesthetic perspective, looks a lot less video gamey to me. And I say video gamey as a pejorative, meaning like it feels like an actual place that I could actually go to. And like the way that the game guides you to the next location feels very organic compared to the first game, which felt more like, oh yes, it's this massive white, like yellow stripe there. And yes, there's a lot of that going on in this game too, but because of the visual fidelity to real life, it feels a lot more subtle in this game. Right.
Yeah.
So
I often felt like I was discovering things that I'm sure they wanted me to do, but I felt like I was doing it.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. I will say a very interesting experience to be playing this game with the WLF. And this game takes place in Seattle. Most of the game is in Seattle at the same time that we were having a Capitol Hill occupied protest here in Seattle. Yeah. And it's just like, wow. Like, and then there's so many times when Ellie goes through some like massive ordeal and then she's like, F Seattle. I hate this city, you know? And I'm like, what is the United States vision of Seattle that they're getting right now? You know, between the chop and also this, this game, you know, like what is people's perception of Seattle? I know we've been going for like 70 minutes, Jeff. We haven't even really talked about the ending yet. So I don't know if you have more time, or I don't know if any of you guys have more time.
I have children that need tending. I don't know if you want to say something quickly about the very end.
No, it's okay. We'll just leave that for future conversation at some point.
For after the credits
at some point.
I thought this was a fantastic conversation.
I really enjoyed talking about this with you guys. Thank you for not completely tearing my arguments to shreds, but leaving them mostly intact. But it's really fun to talk to you guys, because obviously I respect everyone here, and everyone here has various talents and knowledge as it relates to storytelling. So thanks for the conversation, guys.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.